This Week in Radical History for the week of May 12th. Information and inspiration comes from the Slingshot Organizer and the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website. On May 12th, 1927, Nicaragua. Sandino and his guerrillas decide to continue the fight until they defeat the invading U.S. Marines. A Sandino manifesto asserts, "It is better to be killed as a rebel than to live as a slave." May 13th, 1771. Robert Owen, one of the founders of socialism, is born. A forerunner to Marx, Owen once famously said about religion, "It makes mankind a weak, imbecile animal, a furious bigot and fanatic, or a miserable hypocrite." Also on May 13, 1794, Tom the Tinker helps to organize the Whiskey Rebellion, fighting against the federal taxation of small, but not the large, distilleries. George Washington organized a 12,000-plus man army to march into Pennsylvania. Similar to the American Tea Party taxation without representation model used to fight against the English, I guess it was okay for Washington to force taxes on others, just not the other guy. On May 13, 1842, Thomas Dorr's People's Government attempts to seize power in Rhode Island, eventually put down by the state militia. Dorr would eventually be sentenced to life in solitary confinement. On May 13, 1846, U.S. Congress declares war in Mexico. The saying of the day was, "Poor Mexico, so far from God, so close to America." As we take what was to become California, Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas under pressure from the South to turn them into slave-owning states. God bless us all. On May 13, 1954, Marshall Islanders plead to end the H-bomb testing in their area and all the nuclear fallout from it. More anti-American commies, I'm sure. May 13, 1960, the House Un-American Activities Committee meets as students hold sit-in across the country against red-baiting. On this date, May 14, 1856, private American investor William Walker is officially recognized by U.S. President Franklin Pierce as the pro-slavery dictator of Nicaragua after Walker raises and marches a private army into the country. Later, the people depose him. On May 14, 1905, the Asiatic Exclusion League is formed, making the official start to the anti-Japanese movement, the Japanese being the Mexicans' anti-immigration movement of their day. Also on May 14, 1940, anarchist and feminist Emma Goldman dies in Canada while raising money for the anti-Franco whose fascist forces took over Spain. Among many writings of Emma, she famously once said about the American political system, "If voting ever really changed anything, they would have made it illegal." Another famous quote of hers is, "If I can't dance, I don't want to be a part of your revolution." Her grave can be found in Chicago and is a kind of pilgrimage site for many anarchists around the world to visit. Again, Red Emma dies May 14, 1940, in Canada. On May 14, 1960, police beat and drag over 200 protesters at a House Un-American Activities hearing in San Francisco. Police beatings being obviously very American. Also on May 4, 1968, students, followed by many laborers and artists, start strike to take over French government. By the end of the month, over 10 million Frenchmen are involved. Similar demonstrations would spread to Berlin, Rome, Madrid, and other large cities around the world. Capitalists shake in their fur-lined boots. Also on May 4th, 1970, before Kent State, there was Jackson State, where the government shot into the crowd, killing students at anti-war demonstration. However, at Jackson State, the two students were black, therefore not deserving of a pop song like Four Dead in Ohio. On May 5th, 1834, against a Supreme Court ruling, Cherokee Indians forced march out of their lands, which became known as the Trail of Tears. Out of the 12,000 forced marched, almost half died along the way. This mass killing by the U.S. government would spur on the Seminole tribe's resistance in Florida. Also on May 15, 1855, America's first great poet, Walt Whitman, registers the first great book of poetry, Leaves of Grass. Also May 15, 1971, Paris Commune takes over national government seat for 2 months. The National Guard is formed by former army soldiers and laborers to fight against the German-backed forces. Also on May 15, 1935, National Labor Relations Act passed, allowing workers the right to organize in collective bargaining. Also on May 15, 1947, House passes $400 million funding to fight communism, and the first members of the general public start naming names at the House Un-American Activities hearings held in Washington, D.C. Also on May 15, 1964, U.S. starts mass bombing of Laos, effectively destroying this small country. Also on May 15, 1968, students fight German police as new emergency laws are passed to stop public from demonstrating. Also on that date, 1969, then-Governor Ronald Reagan orders raids on the hippies camping in the People's Park. Also on that date, 1970, several million students hold strikes against the war around the nation. Also on May 15, 1971, Several thousand Hopi Indians forced to relocate as strip mining companies take over their lands. Also on May 15, 1989, government records released show that Noral Noriega was the, quote, CIA man, unquote, in Panama. Years later was arrested by U.S. forces and convicted. Can you say Saddam Hussein? On May 16, 1913, first woman's anti-slavery convention is held. Also on May 16, 1871, yes, that's right, 1871, U.S. invades Korea to force open trade routes. He is kicked out a month later. Well, we'll be back again and again. Also May 16, 1904, U.S. deports anarchist John Turner. The Supreme Court rules that the U.S. has the right to deport anyone, even philosophical anarchists, if they so choose. Yep, the land of the free, all right. Also May 16, 1918, President Wilson signs into law the Sedition Act, making it illegal to obstruct, enlist, or speak against war materials, the American government, etc., etc. Ah, more land of the free stuff. Also on May 16, 1933, the first blacklist of unacceptable books is created in Nazi Germany. Also on May 16, 1943, we saw the Warsaw Poland Ghetto Uprising. 53,000 would die eventually. Now it's being fought in the ghettos of Palestine. Now the victims become the victimizers. And it goes on and on and on. That's all the time we got for this week's This Week in Radical History. For more interesting and fun radical facts, check out the People's Calendar by Googling the Daily Bleed. More information also came from the Slingshot Organizer, Google Slingshot Collective for more information. From the Glee Studios, and until next week, as always, I'm yours in a struggle, Mike Cannon.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. In a rather astonishing decision, the State Ethics Commission has summarily rejected Massachusetts Peace Action's complaint regarding the 9 state senators who accepted the December 2015 trip to Israel, organized and paid for by the Jewish Community Relations Council of Boston, the JCRC. The basis for the Massachusetts Peace Action, fondly known as MAPA, that complaint is that the senators violated the Massachusetts Conflict of Interest Law in accepting a trip worth over $4,000 apiece, at the same time the JCRC had anti-BDS legislation pending before the legislature. MAPA anticipated that the Ethics Commission might claim that the trip qualified for the exemption created by the Ethics Commission for travel that serves a, quote, legitimate public purpose, unquote. Although the complaint set forth a number of reasons why the trip didn't, in fact, qualify. This, of course, is not what the Ethics Commission said, however. The Ethics Commission instead argued that no action was necessary in response to MAPA's complaint because the senators had filed the required paperwork, which included their determination that the travel served a legitimate public purpose. In other words, the JCRC trip didn't violate the conflict of interest law because the senators said it didn't. Is it not astonishing that the Ethics Commission doesn't care whether a particular legislative trip paid for by a lobbying organization actually serves a legitimate public purpose, but only whether the recipient legislatures say it does? If legislators in a conflict of interest situation can be trusted to determine whether they qualify for an exemption, why bother with a conflict of interest law in the first place? A sworn statement by each legislator that his or her legislative judgment will not be influenced by gifts in any amount seems to suffice. Most disappointing, the Ethics Commission made no response to MAPA's legal argument that the travel exemption itself violates the conflict of interest law. The Ethics Commission's travel exemption seemingly permits travel that serves a public purpose, even if that travel also presents a genuine risk of a conflict of interest. However, the conflict of interest law limits exemptions to, quote, situations that do not present a genuine risk of a conflict or the appearance of a conflict of interest, unquote. If payment of a Senate trip to Israel paid for by a lobbying group which takes place while there is relevant legislation pending before that body does not at least have the appearance of a conflict of interest, then just what does appearance of conflict of interest mean to our Ethics Commission? It means that the Ethics Commission is a joke, but I guess we already knew that. Okay, Moving on. This week we feature the courageous, indefatigable Israeli journalist Gideon Levy, who defines the term speaking truth to power. Gideon Levy writes for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz and is a frequent speaker sounding the Palestinian narrative not only in the heart of Israel, but throughout the world. We feature him on This Week in Palestine whenever we can. This week's presentation was given at Brandeis University. Here is Israeli journalist Gideon Levy.
I'm very happy to be here today. Unfortunately, it seems that it's quite a sympathetic audience. In New York, we faced some disturbances and challenged us, I must say. I'm now at 10, almost 8, 9 days on the road, and we had some very good opportunities. And in those 10 days, things in Israel deteriorated so much that people told me that you will not recognize Israel that you left just 10 days ago. Things are really getting out of control, and we'll try to get to it. But let's speak first of all about the core issue in my view. Many times you are being told that the conflict in the Middle East is a very complicated conflict, and one cannot describe it in black and white. So I would like to suggest to you today that it is a very simple conflict, a real estate conflict, with very clear black and white, with very clear justice and injustice. And one might even ask if it is a conflict at all. Because when France occupied Algeria, nobody spoke about the French-Algerian conflict. There was a French occupation in Algeria, and when this French occupation in Algeria came to its end, the conflict was over. Not complicated, not nothing. Very, very simple. Black and white it was. When it comes to the Israeli-Palestinian, whatever we call it, those who claim that it is a complicated conflict means to say that this conflict cannot be solved, that this conflict has too many sides, but by the end of the day, it's all about justice, relative justice, by the way, not total justice, because total justice will never be achieved. Relative justice, very relative justice, and above all, and that's the core word, above all about equality. And as long as Israelis will not perceive the Palestinians as equal human beings, which they don't, and I'll elaborate about this, as long as they don't perceive them as equal human beings, nothing will be solved. And once they will perceive them as equal human beings, everything will seem totally different. I don't want to say that everything will be very simple to be solved after all those years of hatred, of fears, surely not. But it will seem totally different. For many years I'm asking myself, how come that the Israeli occupation lasts for so many years, when the Israeli society lives with it, with so much peace, with so little doubt, with so little moral questions, with such self-content and convenience that and confidence, such confidence that we are not only right, we are the only one to be right. With this confidence that the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, is the most moral army in the world. Many times I try to suggest to the Israelis, maybe the IDF is the second moral army in the world. You know, by the end of the day, an army which killed 500 women and 500 children last summer in Gaza, maybe it's not directly connected to morality. Or maybe it is really the second moral army in the world, and the army of Luxembourg, let's put this army, if it exists at all. Do you have an army? Do you have an army? No army, sorry. Not Luxembourg, Liechtenstein. The army of Liechtenstein is the most moral army in the world. And Israelis, rightly so, will be deeply offended. How can you dare to put a question mark at all about the morality of the in the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces? This deep conviction that everything is right, the occupation is right, brings you to ask yourself, how is it possible for so many years? And here I want to suggest a few possible answers which rely on very deep-rooted beliefs and values in Israeli society, which enable us Israelis for so many years to maintain this occupation. And as the famous advertisement, Israeli advertisement for brass goes, to go with and to feel without. We go with the occupation and we feel almost totally without. The first very deep-rooted belief, in my view, which is almost general in Israel, even if it's not outspoken, is the belief that we are the chosen people. Religious and seculars will share this view. They will not phrase it in the same way. The religious will talk more about the God who chose us to be the chosen people. Others will just say that we are the best, we know the best, we are always the best, and nobody will tell us what to do. This very deep-rooted value enables us Israelis to believe that there are certain things that are allowed to us and are forbidden to the rest of the world because we are different, because we are the chosen people. Let's take, for example, a small example, the international law. Extremely important, vital. This international law, which, by the way, was formulated after World War II and after what happened in World War II. It's extremely important. It applies to all the countries in the world. Not only Israel. Because we are a special case. So, international law, which defines very clearly what are crimes of war, what is the meaning of occupation, what is the meaning of settlement, it doesn't apply to Israel. Why? Because that's the first set of values. The second very deep-rooted value is the fact that we, the Jewish people, and we, the Israelis, are, first of all, the biggest victim in history. But what is more important to say, we are the only victim in history. Or at least the only victim in history that should be taken seriously as a victim. Because even the Armenians are not suiting enough to carry the title of being a big victim of history. This enables us to think that if we are the biggest victims in history, again, it gives us special rights and special privileges because we are victims. The late Golda Meir, Israeli Prime Minister, phrased it in the best way. She said it directly. She always said direct things. She said, after the Holocaust, the Jews have the right to do whatever they want. As simple as that. That's the lesson. And that's the lesson that, in one way or the other, we are trying to teach the younger generations in Israel when we send all of them with tens of thousands to Auschwitz, to those studying missions. That's basically the message that they get there. We are the victims, we are the only victims, and after the Holocaust we have the right to do whatever we want, and our only way to live will be on our sword, on our military power, and all the rest is quite minor. Because one should remember that there were more brutal occupations in history, and there were even longer occupations in history than the Israeli one. But I cannot recall one example in which the occupier presented himself as the victim. This occupation was forced upon us. We never wanted those territories. We never want to rule the Palestinians. We don't want it, but it was imposed on us like an earthquake, like a catastrophe, like the force majeure. And we are the victims. And again, if to quote another lovely, lovely, lovely quotation from the late Golda Meir, I like to quote her here because you Americans exported her to us. She was born in Milwaukee. She was brought up in Milwaukee. She said another very, very interesting sentence, which is very typical. She said once that we will never forgive the Palestinians for forcing us to kill their children. So we are the victims. We kill their children, but we are obviously the victims. That's the subtext. So this feeling, very deep feeling of being the victims, with everything that goes around it, paranoia of victims, fears of victims, present ourselves for years as the David against this Goliath, as the weak one who is always in existential danger. When you speak about securities, always about the security of the Israelis, you have never heard anybody talk about the security of the Palestinians, because we are the victims. This enables us also to live in peace with the occupation, because victims can occupy, because they were victims. But that's not enough. And to this one should add another very deep-rooted belief in Israeli society. If you stretch under the skin of almost every Israeli, you will find out that Israelis perceive, I'll be very careful here, perceive the Palestinians not exactly as equal human beings like them. I once wrote that we treat the Palestinians like animals, and I got so many protest letters from animal rights organizations who rightly claim that even animals should have their own rights. But it's very clear that most of the Israelis don't perceive the Palestinians as equal human beings, and then question of human rights are less relevant because we deal with something which is not exactly like us. They were born to kill, they are cruel, they are bloodthirsty, they almost all of them are terrorists. The only thing they want is to throw us Israelis to the ocean. That's the only goal in their lives. And this enables, again, to live in peace with an occupation and not to feel any moral doubts. So these three sets of beliefs, which are, again, I say, so deep-rooted, enable Israelis not to really be aware to what is being done on their behalf. For this, we have also very successful agencies which help us to keep, to maintain those beliefs, and above all the Israeli media, which is a free media. Most of it is commercial, privately owned, without not too much ideology, but wants to please the Israelis, don't want to bother the Israelis, wants to sell newspapers, to have high rating, and not to tell the full story, which most of the Israelis don't want to know. And here we get Israeli public agenda that anyone who comes from abroad can't believe how absent is the occupation in the public discourse in Israel. It doesn't exist at all. I mean, I remember years in which the joke was that two Israelis share three views. Today's three Israelis hardly share one view. Last elections, the last campaign, nobody mentioned the occupation, not from right, not from left, nothing. As if it doesn't exist, this huge elephant in our room, and no one sees this elephant. And we think that if we don't talk about this elephant, if we don't direct our eyes at this elephant, the elephant is not in the room. But the elephant is in the room, and will never leave this room. And so, Israelis train themselves to live in peace with the occupation. But then there is another problem. The world is very clear about the Israeli occupation, at least in a declarative level. I can't recall one issue, which the entire world is united about, like the lack of legitimacy of the Israeli occupation. No country, including even Micronesia, Israel's second ally, even Micronesia does not recognize the Israeli occupation, even not 1 meter of this occupation, and so does even the United States, and we'll get to the United States soon. So we have a problem. The world is very clear about it. So this problem was also solved. The world is anyhow against Israel. Most of the world is anti-Semitic. Let's face it. Yeah. Any criticism on Israel is anti-Semitism. And by this, again, we released ourselves of any responsibility because it's the world's blame, not ours. The fact that the world hugged Israel after Oslo, rightly so, wrongly so, hugged Oslo, hugged Israel, is forgotten. Because then one can ask, where was all this anti-Semitism in the 90s, where really the world was hugging Israel, when there was really a hope for ending the occupation? No. So there is this protective shield in which Israelis believe that doesn't matter what the world says because the world is anti-Semitic and one shouldn't listen to the world. And here we face this occupation, which creates a very interesting situation in Israel. I think it's the only country in the world which possesses three regimes. Not one, not two, three regimes. In the front, we have this liberal democracy for its Jewish citizens, quite a liberal democracy which enables almost full freedom of speech, freedom of movement, all the basic values, with a lot of cracks, recently even more so. Nothing should be taken for granted. There are really big dangers to Israeli democracy for its Jewish citizens. With anti-democratic legislations in the recent years, really anti-democratic legislations, but still one can claim that this is a democracy. Then comes the second regime in Israel, and this is the regime toward its Palestinian citizens. 20% of the population of Israel are what we like to call Israeli Arabs, Palestinians who live in Israel, in sovereign Israel, and have full civil rights. They have passports, they vote to the parliament, they can be elected to the parliament, they are represented in the parliament. They gain a formal democracy with very, very deep discrimination in any possible field, but still they are equal citizens on the formal level. So this is the second regime, a regime of discrimination toward the Palestinian citizenship. And then comes obviously the third regime of Israel, and this is a regime that Israel is having in the occupied territories, in the West Bank, and in a different way on Gaza. A regime that is by far today one of the most brutal tyrannies on earth. There are very, very few more cruel or more brutal totalitarian regimes than the totalitarian regime of Israel in the occupied territories. A regime which cannot be defined but as an apartheid regime, when two peoples share one piece of land and one people gains all the rights in the world and the other people gain no right in the world. It looks like apartheid, it works like apartheid, and it is apartheid. And that's the third regime of Israel, the apartheid in its dark backyard. Now, some of you might know by now that there is nothing like being half pregnant. It doesn't work. Many times maybe we wish it would have worked, it doesn't work. Either you are pregnant or you are not. Same applies about democracy. There is nothing like half democratic. Either you are a democracy or you are not. And you can't be a democracy or claim to be the only democracy in the Middle East when in your backyard you possess one of the most brutal tyrannies on earth today. It doesn't go together. And therefore, the Israeli claim that it is a democracy is a very problematic claim. As long as this is going on in its backyard. And I must remind you here that Israel exists many, many, many more years with the occupation rather than without it. So nobody can claim anymore that we are dealing with a temporary phenomenon. The occupation is part and parcel of Israel. So we are facing this not very promising picture in which the Israelis are living in peace with the occupation. The occupation is getting just stronger and deeper. More and more settlements are built, as you know. We are facing now between 600,000 to 700,000 settlers in the West Bank with no intention to leave, with no Israeli serious politician who have the slightest intention to put an end to it. And then comes the question, how do we continue from here? Where is some kind of source of hope? So here I must say, again, you can take my word, you can obviously not take it, but I think I know the Israeli society quite well after so many years of living there. Don't have any expectations for change from within the Israeli society. It will not come. Life in Israel is too good. Brainwash machine is too effective. I don't see it happening or coming from within, a change coming from within the Israeli society. No politicians who suggest any kind of real change, no alternative. There are some devoted groups and individuals which are really remarkable, and don't take me wrong, they really are adorable. But they are very small in numbers, and they are totally delegitimized by the Israeli media and the Israeli society. And therefore their influence is almost nothing. I say it with a lot of frustration, but it's a matter of fact. Organizations like Breaking the Silence and B'Tselem and Physicians for Human Rights and Anarchists Against the Fence and Ta'ayush and Machsom Watch and many others and individuals who go and demonstrate every week in Bilin, in Alin, in Ebisaler, in many places. Remarkable people. In Sheikh Jarrah in Jerusalem. But the influence is limited, if not less than this. And I think that as long as this set of conditions will continue, no change will come from the Israeli society. There's no incentive for change. Why? Why would a Tel Avivian who is now so troubled about his next vacation or next jeep be troubled by those settlers and the occupied territories, a place where he had never visited, and hears about it so little and knows about it so little? Why should he bother about this at all? Who cares? You know, those nudniks with the kibbush, with the occupation again, again. How many times can we hear about the occupation? Really, give us a break. And I don't see, and obviously the collaboration of the Israeli media, which is by far the biggest collaborator with the Israeli occupation, I don't see any chance for change from within the Israeli society. And then the question is, what are we supposed to do? Those who care, those who don't want to live with this forever, or those who understand that the status quo will not last forever? Because there is not one single example in human history in which any empire lived on its sword forever. Doesn't exist. And here I stand here and I suggest that the only hope for people like me, at least, is the international community. Now, in the international community, there are two levels. There's the level of the civil societies, of the public opinions, and there is the level of the governments. With the governments, we are doing very badly. And above all, unfortunately, with yours, which could have become so easily a game changer. I truly believe that the day there will be an American president who will really want to put an end to the occupation will come to its end within months. But this day never came. And there was, until today, not one single American president who really wanted to put an end to the occupation. Because Israel is as depending as never before in the United States. But this doesn't happen. Many times, you know, when one looks at the relations between Israel and the United States, one can ask himself, who is exactly the superpower between the two? Yes. And who is in the pocket of whom? Yes. And who flatters to whom? And who tries to please whom? And who tries to apologize all the time in front of whom? We had now the agreement with Iran. President Obama was generous enough to offer Israel compensation for the agreement.
Compensation for what?
Israel is the biggest actor who gets the best out of this agreement. The best out of this agreement. Why compensation? But okay, generosity of presidents is always welcome in Israel. But not in this case. Because Mr. Netanyahu announced the American administration that he is not ready yet to discuss the compensation. Not yet. Time will come, but not yet. And the American administration is swallowing it and say nothing. An Israeli ambassador is sitting in Washington, knocking on the door of almost each congressman and senator, trying to recruit legislators against the administration. And this is accepted. I can't think about one single state that would have dared to behave like this. I can't think about the Americans. Can you see an American ambassador sitting in Jerusalem, in the Knesset, in the Israeli parliament, trying to recruit Israeli parliamentarians against the prime minister? But Israeli ambassador can do it, and he was doing it until the agreement with Iran was accepted. And even this was accepted in this country. So we have a problem with governments. Europe, needless to say, is a pale shadow of the United States when it comes to the Middle East. Europe also carries its own complexes, guilt feelings, historical guilt, and the expectation that Europe, or at least part of Europe, on a governmental level, will really change is quite small. But the potential is so big. I'll give you an example. I wanted to write an article in the last war on Gaza that Austrian Airlines can bring peace to the Middle East. You might ask, why Austrian Airlines? I'll tell you very simply, because Austrian Airlines stopped its flights to Israel in the middle of the war for 18 hours maybe. And after Austrian Airlines, there were most of the Western airlines who declared that they don't fly to Israel. I can tell you 18 hours Israelis almost got mad, but they survived. If it would have become 18 days, I think Israel would have given up all the entire occupied territories, including Jerusalem. But being more serious, it's very clear to me that civil societies and organizations and individuals can start to make a difference. Because people like me believe that Israeli society needs a wake-up call. And I'll be more harsh than this. Let's be frank, Israelis deserve to be punished for the occupation and for the crimes. And Israelis deserve to be taken accountable for those crimes. And, you know, it's not very easy to be saved by an Israeli who lives in Israel. But if I'll be very sincere with you, that's my very genuine emotion. I think that people who are responsible for crimes should pay for them. I don't think that anyone has any doubts about how criminal is the occupation, how many crimes are being committed on a daily basis, by the way. Crimes of war on a daily basis. On a weekly basis, in very peaceful periods, we can say on a weekly basis. So I think that a wake-up call to the Israeli society and a very clear message that crimes must be brought to justice and criminals must be brought to justice might make a change. It was very effective with apartheid South Africa. It was one of the game changers, as you know. I just want to warn you here that in South Africa, I was told that one of the main effective boycotts was the boycott on sport. With Israel, it will not work so well because Israel is not doing very well in sport. So I'm not sure that a boycott on sport will be the real game changer. But I truly believe that it's now for the international community to say its word. Is it acceptable in the 21st century to have an apartheid system anywhere? Is it acceptable in the 21st century to have still a military occupation, one of the last ones on Earth? Is it acceptable to continue to have a colonization of a piece of land, one of the last, if not the last, colonialistic regimes? And if it's not acceptable, what are we doing about it? And the question comes, the next question obviously is the question, what can be the solution? Because it's very nice to say that the status quo is not acceptable, but what can bring real justice to the Middle East? And for many years I was obviously, like maybe most of you, I don't know, I was a great supporter obviously of the two-state solution. I thought this is the easiest way, this is the more practical way, this is the, maybe even the more just way to divide this land for two peoples. Each people will have its own state, independent, self-definition, and this can be the solution. I still believe that this is the best solution. There's one slight, very small problem that I think that this train left the station already, and it is nature of trains, unfortunately, so they never come back. I'm not sure they can come back, but they left the station. This train left the station, in my view. I'll be the happiest person on earth to be convinced that I'm wrong, that the two-state solution is still applicable. I have my doubts because with 700,000 settlers, I don't see any Israeli politician evacuating 700,000 settlers, and I don't see any viable Palestinian state with those 700,000 settlers or even part of them staying where they are. We know exactly why they went there, or at least most of them went there. They went to prevent any kind of settlement. This was their basic motivation. They went to prevent any possibility for the two-state solution. And I think it's time to admit that they won. This powerful, the most powerful political group in Israeli society, maybe the only group, big, meaningful group, which was really ready to struggle on its cause or causes, won. And with 700,000 people, settlers, I don't see how a two-state solution is still something that is achievable. And again, I must emphasize, anyone who will prove me wrong, I'll be very happy to admit that I was wrong. More and more people understand that the two-state solution is either dead or dying, but it takes some time to change, because this is something that people were fighting for decades now. And to admit that we lost is not something very, very simple. But I think it's time to stop speaking about the two-state solution only because of one reason. Because I think that most of those who continue to talk about the two-state solution are doing so only to gain more time, to deepen the occupation, to build more settlements. And therefore, the discourse, at least the international discourse, I think, should change. And we have to start to talk about equal rights. Because equal rights is something that no one in Israel will be able to refuse and not give an explanation. Why are you against equal rights? Because you are chosen people. I mean, why not equal rights to everybody who lives between the river and the sea? So many Israelis will tell you, horrified, then it's the end of the Jewish state, and the whole dream was a Jewish state. Fine, not that I know what does it mean, a Jewish state. I'm not sure that America is an American state. I've never heard that France is a French state. It's not for me to define a state according to ethnic or religious definitions. But those Israelis who, for them, this is vital to have a Jewish state, without even knowing what does it mean, to them I can very easily say, where have you been until now? Anyone who wants a Jewish state should be for the two-state solution long time ago and do something about it. Because the only way to have a Jewish state is by maintaining a Jewish majority. And Jewish majority can only be in the 67 borders. Any other borders, you don't have a Jewish majority. And then they say it must be Jewish and democratic. The democratic sounds always like a lip service. Because most of the intelligent people understand that there is nothing like Jewish and democratic. Because it's a built-in contradiction. Because if you are Jewish, the translation of it is privileges to one people on the other. This has nothing to do with democracy. This is anti-democracy. If you want a Jewish state, you need, first of all, a Jewish majority. But still, what about the minorities' rights? Why to define it as Jewish or not Jewish? Let it be a democratic state. And you know, if there will be a Jewish majority, they will decide they want a Jewish state, which means, I don't know what, that each of us will have to go with a beard and wear a yarmulke. Okay, but it must be a democratic state before anything else. So in this stage, when the two-state solution is dying or dead, I think that the international community and people like you, who I guess have interest and have knowledge and have this urge to do something, must start to change the discourse and start to talk about equal rights. I know it's a long, long, long way. I know that to speak now about the one democratic state sounds terrible and sounds lunatic and sounds, especially with the background of what's going on now, with all the hatred and the fear from both sides, by the way. How can you make this work? It sounds really almost impossible. But first of all, one should not judge the future according to the present situation. The whole idea is to change the present. The whole idea is to change the present reality. And not to continue the present. Sure, if we continue the present reality, there is no way that Jews and Palestinians will be able to live together in peace or in democracy or in equality. But the idea is to change this. And anyone who has a better idea is invited always to raise it. I don't see any other way but to start to talk about equal rights, because I don't see any other option. No other option was left, mainly because of the Israelis. They didn't leave much option for anything else. And therefore, that's the time to start to speak about it, to start to raise it, and to start to push for it. And still, it's not a very optimistic vision, as you can imagine yourself, when people are stabbing each other in the streets of Israel, and lynches are being taking place almost on a daily basis, and people are executed on a daily basis, and people are killed, and so much bloodshed. To speak about equal rights for everyone and one state solution, I just must remind you, before you get so shocked by this, that one state exists now for 48 years. It's not that I come here and suggest something unheard of. It is a one state for 48 years. The only problem is that it's not a democratic state. That it is a state with three regimes, as I try to describe. But it is a one state. The Green Line doesn't exist anymore for a long time. It is one entity. And the fate of my Palestinian friends here is much more decided in Jerusalem rather than in Ramallah. And when President Abbas wants to move from one town to the other in the West Bank, he needs permission from Israel. So it is one state. Let's not cheat ourselves. And if it is one state, then it is one state. So the only struggle is now, what kind of one state will it be? And to conclude this, I know those things sound right now not very realistic, but I can tell you one thing, that if we all of us would have met in the late 80s, and I would have told you in the late 80s, listen, within months, apartheid system is going to fall, Soviet Russia, big Soviet Russia is going to fall, and the Berlin Wall is going to fall, I can assure you, you would have never invited me to lecture here again. Because you would have been totally convinced that I'm out of my mind. Nobody had foreseen all those things. Nobody. And it happened. So many times things in history happen in an unexpected way, in an unexpected timing. I was enjoying Connecticut in the recent days, and I went every day with my partner, Patrick, for a walk in the morning through the woods, and I saw all those beautiful, beautiful trees, part of them lying on the ground. Strong, beautiful trees lying on the ground. Many times it happens. And you ask yourself, how come such a strong tree fall down? And then you look inside and you see it was totally rotten or hollow from inside. And I don't think that anyone can think here about something which is more rotten than the Israeli occupation. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to Israeli journalist Gideon Levy speaking at Brandeis University. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002, and has been broadcast on community radio stations in Preston, Swindon and St Albans. We're on Bristol Community FM every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week, the final part of our exclusive interview with former SAS soldier and ABC television executive Barry Wynn, author of Breath in the Dark, Jane Hersey, and Thomas Barlow from Real Media, a Manchester new media startup which is taking over where the London media has failed. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk, and if you want to join in, contact People's Republic of Stokes Croft, who are just off Jamaica Street. Call them on 0117 909 6897 or visit them on the web at prsc.org.uk, and I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show. What about the modern world? Let's just bring it up to the present, because you know, the
the golden age of television is gone. The golden age of the film. Film is gone. We've got these various different crises now, haven't we? We've got the Middle East seems to be regime change every 5 minutes, with West against East, a kind
never
of new,
changes.
Almost a new Cold War. And also the financial problems that are right across Europe. What do you make as someone, you know, with all this experience from the past of these major problems we've got in the world today still?
Well, as ever, we have to look to our youth. But unfortunately, this is only a very personal opinion, the youth of today have become totally materialistic, really, and they think life is just a bowl of cherries. They don't realise what my father's generation did for this country in fighting that thing. And the fact that they live in peace now, certainly in our country and most of Europe, it's quite insignificant because they never tasted the fear that we had. I remember during the war, we were frightened to death of the arrival of the Germans. And they've lived in such easy life by comparison.
Yeah. You say they've been mollycoddled?
Well, I believe in the youth. I've always believed in the youth. We've gone through this a million times, you know, in our past. But they have to learn. And one hopes that with sort of reservations about Europe. We would all like to be in a Europe. I mean, it was Winston Churchill who first talked about passport-free Europe and all the rest of it. And it was always conceived as a marketplace of which we would be a member. Now it's become, you know, a nation state, if they could get it there. And the bureaucracy. Oh.
The other thing, of course, is that we're seeing a big gap opening up between rich and poor in Britain again, aren't we?
Yes, I think that is extraordinary. It's a phenomena, really. I mean, this is the materialistic part of it, isn't it, really? Money is all important. And there are certain people that know how to make it. And that, you know, I'm afraid it's one of the things, greed.
We have Chancellor George Osborne. I mean, I know you live in Cyprus, so you may be not on top of what's going on in Britain, but he says he's going to balance the books, and he says to do it, we've got to spend less as a government. But that itself seems to be strangling off the economy.
Well, I don't think we strangled off the economy. I think it's worked. I think it's worked. It's very unpleasant. But if you want to make money, you've got to have the right people at the top to make it, and they've got to have the reason for doing it. I don't like it. This is the way the Americans do it.
I mean, we're sitting here in Wales today, Port Talbot Steelworks, they're now talking about the possibility of that closing. That does suggest there simply isn't the demand out there, there isn't the building going on, there isn't the need for these basic things for industry like steel.
Yes, I know. Well, I think they're totally wrong, of course. I mean, a little ridiculous thing. I do my own mending of my clothes and things like that. Needles that we used to have before the war from Sheffield Steel were so sharp at the point that, you know, if you happened to touch your fingernail with the point, it would go in and you'd bleed because it was the finest possible steel. Needles today, and the cotton is rubbish, and it all comes from China. What's the matter with us?
Well, it almost sounds like the 1984, you know, George Orwell's book, where he talks about the cigarettes, where as if you tip the cigarette slightly, all the tobacco rolls out the end of it.
Yes, I know. It is, you know. Of course, this always moves in a cycle. It will come round. We will realise, you know, the error of our ways, I think. But I believe in the Commonwealth, actually. I think that the Commonwealth, if you look at the globe, I've just written an article about it, as a matter of fact, from, I was asked, actually, by the same publisher to go down and interview, with a possibility of doing a book, Dr. Barnes Wallace, as he then was. And so I did what I was told to do. I was still in the television world, but I sort of got onto this thing that You don't write one book. If it's a success, you've suddenly got a hell of a tax problem, and so you've got to do another one, and it sort of gets into a mad cycle that never seems to get finished off. So Ernest said, I think this is a book in Dr. Barnes Wallace. He's an amazing man. I said, oh, I don't even know who he is. He said, well, he's this and that and the rest of it. Go down and see him. I said, very well. So I went down, and I found him on the old Croydon airport in a section of Nissen huts left over from the Second World War. I'm a young whippersnapper, no school certificate, don't forget, and now to be questioning this brilliant mathematician. I walked in correctly on time. Very, very nice elder gentleman got up and said, how nice to meet you, do come in. We sat down, and I looked around the Nissen huts, and I noticed something. Because I'm not a talented person, but I am an observer, that I must say. And I noticed that all the people there were girls. And I thought, well, that's strange. So we were trying to open conversation. And I said, there are no men here. He said, no, I won't work with men. I said, why is that? You see, laughing. And he said, always got something else on their mind. This was, don't forget, before the age of computers. He said, all I want is mathematical results. I put down on a piece of paper to girl number one, work this out. When you've done so, give me the answer. And I spread it out around my thing. They concentrate totally on what they're doing. And I find that I can work far better with women, young graduate mathematicians, and that's the way I work. And so a very interesting conversation came out of this. He said, do you know the name Bartholomew? I am an uneducated young man. I said, do you mean the map maker? I didn't know that. He said, yes, a mathematician. Oh, I said that. He said, have you ever thought of why the meridian of zero runs through Greenwich? Well, I said, no, not really. He said, it is because, as a mathematician, if you were to try and work out the focal point of the five continents on this planet, there's only one place that zero can go, and that goes on the line through Greenwich. Whether it's true or not, I've not the remotest idea, but that's what he told me, and I'm a student at the seat of this man. And so he said, don't forget, it's 50 years ago. He said, I cannot understand for the life of me why the aero industry, he worked for British Aircraft Corporation, are trying to do the most difficult technical thing it's possible to conceive. I said, oh, what's that, Dr. Wallace? To drive ever bigger, ever heavier aircraft ever faster through the thickest part of the atmosphere. He said, it's the most difficult thing you can possibly do. He said, 200,000 feet above us is unlimited energy force. We shouldn't be going fighting with huge weights of fuel and everything else to get into that. What we should be doing is going up slowly to counter gravity, slip it into the jet stream, and he said we'll be able to go to Sydney in 90 minutes, including takeoff and landing. That is all I can tell you with my hand on my heart, is what he told me. Now we've got the things. And do you know something? I think he's probably right. We need little tiny things with miniaturized power force. How they do that, I don't know. But just slowly to go up there, flick it in there, and there we are. We've got all that space, unlimited fuel, get around the globe in no time at all. That's what he told me.
What about Britain today? Because, I mean, everybody was very impressed by Britain's empire, although obviously there were a lot of people around the world that came a cropper. We've just had recently the Australian universities saying actually Australia wasn't colonised, it was invaded, it was surrounded, and it was there was a genocide that went on in Australia. So there is a lot of questioning.
By Australians. You're talking about genocide.
Well, I'm talking about the original takeover. I mean, the British, for example, over in North America as well. The Native Americans, many of those were killed, and there's been a lot of genocide by the British over the centuries. Many people see us as the bullies, of the world.
To entertain us with all this? No, I don't think so. You see, in the old days of the aristocrats, the eldest son would inherit the estates, which he had to run profitably for the family. The second son had behind a job. What's he going to go into? Well, he might go into law. Then there's the third son. What are we going to do with Harry? Send him to India or send him to somewhere or another, you see. So they went out there, commercially minded, not militarily minded. I was in Malaysia 2 years after the Japanese had gone out, and already control had been brought back. You know what I mean? We were probably arrogant, but basically we wanted, for the further of trade and one thing or another, a country that which was well run. None of these countries were properly run.
Well, some people would say Britain isn't very well run today.
I would agree with you.
What do you think's the future for Britain anyway?
Once again, you come back to the young people. We're a generous nation. I believe in our young people. If we set our mind to it, we can do it. But this business of just because you've got a degree, I've got two daughters, they've got their degrees. And in Cyprus, for instance, I had a conversation because I've got some friends there who have a kiosk, a cigarette kiosk, and I sit there almost every day when I go there. And one of their daughters has just got her degree. She's going to be a doctor. She's got a doctorate and everything else in Glasgow. And we were talking, and she came back for Christmas, and we were talking there. And we were talking about the thing and money and all the rest of it, you see, and she said, I said to her, you've now got your alphabet. She looked at me, highly intelligent. I beg your pardon. I said, you've got your alphabet now. This degree has got you your alphabet. I said, this is just the beginning. You won't mean until you're 50 and with a wise woman, because you will learn from experience. She said, I spent 8 years doing this. I said, darling, it's the alphabet. Now you've got to put it to work. She was very quiet and probably hated me, but nevertheless, that's what I said. I said the same to my daughters. You know, yes, you've got the degrees, wonderful. That is the start. You've now got an educated mind to know how to tackle these problems, but you've got to sort of, you know, put that to work. So I'm very optimistic in a way, but I mean, there's so many things which are so deplorable. It is dreadful, some of the things that we see, but I suppose it's always been the same.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I can remember growing up and seeing the first homeless people on the streets of London, for example, begging, and we're seeing more and more of that today, aren't we?
We are seeing more and more of that. And it's interesting that there's so many ex-forces people amongst the people that are in jail. Now, why is that? I asked myself, why is that? The thing is that very cleverly, the forces have really offered a new family to young people. It is their family. It's the destruction of the families that we've made a mistake in. I remember when my father, he had to go into a terminal hospital for 1 year. It was a ghastly place, to be honest with you. We tried to have him at home. Couldn't be done, and he went to this hospital. And it was mostly the nurses were male nurses, and many of them were Chinese. And when he passed away, I managed to get to the hospital, I think 30 seconds before he passed. Just enough time for me to kiss his forehead. And standing there like sentinels were all these nurses, and there was a very nasty atmosphere, smell in these in this ward, and trying to be nice and to thank one of these Chinese boys standing there, I said, well, thank you very much. I said, what do you do with this problem in China? And he looked at me and he said, we would never allow our parents to end their lives in a place like this. Put me in my place, I mean, you know. And he meant it. We destroyed the family. Why has that happened? I suppose because people don't believe in their religion anymore. It's destroyed the kind of the texture of life that we had, where you tried to live a good Christian life.
It's interesting, isn't it? A lot of young people say, for example, you ask them who Moses was, they might not be able to tell you.
No, but I mean, I don't think they've ever... I've just given... Well, I don't want to go into this, but why I'm here in Wales is because of the passing of my son. And I had to think for 3 or 4 weeks what to say, and I said it. And I think it all went over reasonably well. And I know that a lot of the young people have never even read the Bible. And actually, I recited the end, as the end thing, the 23rd Psalm, which I've known all my life, of course. And I said to them at the end, I don't know, I didn't say it in these words now, and I can't remember how I said it, only yesterday, but I said, I don't know how many of you have ever read the Bible, but remember that the Bible has been the best-selling book for hundreds and hundreds of years, and it still is. Now then, the philosophy... You can't beat it. You may not be able to do it because we can't do it. It's too hard, but it's yet terribly simple. So I then, because most of my audience were my sons, my grandchildren there, 11 of them, I think it was, who've never seen me before. And I said, we will never meet again. Doesn't matter. Lovely to be with you today. It's a sad day, but it isn't a sad day. I said, as I came here, all the daffodils are out. There are lambs in the field. This is a rebirth. You've got to carry on. And I said, I don't know how many of you read the good book, and I'm not a highly religious person in a way, but I keep to my original teachings. I said, but do you know something? I said, there isn't one of you here that won't sometime face a crisis. It may be a broken love affair. It may be that you're facing an operation. And at the moment of dire stress, like before the Battle of Alamein, every officer knew that General Montgomery read a chapter of his Bible every night before he went to bed. I said, the funny thing is, you probably haven't read your Bible. But shall I tell you something? If after I've recited these words to you, you think there's something in them, and you're facing a crisis, I said, flick open your laptop, press Bible, punch in Psalm, punch in 2:3, and you can hear it, because you are carrying the Bible and every word in it every day, but you don't realize it. You may never see it, may never read it on paper, but I said, papyrus is where it started. And when I was in the army, I remember a chap in the barrack room say, there's no record of this. It's all rubbish. It's people telling stories. But then suddenly, a few years later, they find the Dead Sea Scrolls. And I took my daughters to see the Dead Sea Scrolls in Jerusalem, because I thought they should see it. I don't think they believe it or anything else. They're just to them, it's a parchment that's stretched out in the cabinet, and they look at it. But funnily enough, the words are exactly... And they are in the Bible, which is very interesting. So I think it's the... I don't know what it is. It's the lack of faith, spirituality, and I think it's very, very sad. But it's still there. I believe in the young people, and gradually they probably will come round to it and say, well, this isn't right. We've got to do something about this. And, you know, it's the way it is. We learn through our experience.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
My name's Thomas Barlow. My cooperative is called Real Media. We launched in 2014 with several years working for Real Fair before that, which became Real Media. Real Fair was a welfare rights blog. And then we've turned into a full media organisation that produces videos, has social media feeds. We aggregate other independent media from around the internet, and we've done a variety of stories, from whistleblowing stories in investigative journalism to media critique, and a lot of stuff on climate change. And we try and cover the gamut, basically, and we're trying to set up a new way of doing media in the 21st century.
But, I mean, a little group like you, how could you ever compete against the monolithic giants, the, you know, the Murdochs, people like that in London?
Well, Murdoch is losing a lot of money currently, and, you know, he retains the press side of his operation purely for political power.
How can he carry on just losing money?
Yeah, I'm not sure he can. You know, I mean, this is what was shown up by Leveson, that there was a move, a potential move, to de-seat him and sell off the press titles and just keep Sky, which is the one that's making the money. You know, the fact is, the future of the press is uncertain, and in these times we have a lot cheaper way to access. It's a bit like the printing press all over again. Suddenly we've got a cheap way with people who care about it, who are well-trained, who do it in their spare time or for small sums of money. And as we build up, we are preparing for a launch in October of something very, very special, with a lot of celebrities, a lot of full-scale support from across the sector, and this is what is going to turn into a new model of funding journalism in the 21st century.
Well, you say funding, but I mean, even people like The Guardian, The Independent, just folded through really lack of advertising.
Yeah, well, there's a lack of advertising because they've also got a lack of circulation. And the circulation comes from the fact that The Independent supported the Conservatives in the last election. The Guardian has been seen as anti-Corbyn and is hemorrhaging readers. The fact is that the press seems biased and seems to be taking editorial lines out of sync with the largest age cohort in Britain now is millennials. They represent 20 million people in this country. It's now a larger age cohort than the baby boomers.
So hang on, who are the millennials?
Millennials are people born after 1982 to the mid-90s. Yeah, the millennials are people like myself who came of age at 18 on the millennium. They're young, internet savvy, have grown up mostly only ever knowing PCs and internet, and they have a different approach. Over 55% of them get their news and information from social media totally. They do not go to single news sources. They do not buy. The understanding the old press has of how to reach these is completely limited by the fact that the doors are closed for our generation to get into those organisations.
But can you actually turn the advertising revenue in order to support yourself?
Well, we won't do it through advertising revenue. What has been shown to work in America especially, they're 6 or 7 years ahead of us with new media, is, say, an organisation like the Young Turks, which has 250 million views per month. They do it on a subscriber basis, or what is called the freemium model. You give most of your content away for free, and you give a certain amount away paid. People don't pay you for the premium stuff. They do a bit, but mostly they pay you because they recognise what you're doing as a service, and that is the way that the modern economy, it's the way Spotify works, it's the way Wikipedia works, it's the way the biggest organisations in the modern world work. It's something the press hasn't caught up with. They're not going to get it. And the Guardian's tried to move towards a membership model, but the problem is they've tried to move towards a membership model just at the same time as they alienated a great deal of their readership base. The important thing is that you provide a service for your readership, and that's not advertisers, it's not corporate sponsors, it's not the state, it's going to be the people. And so it's a new democratic age, but it works. It's already making money. You're seeing it in hyperlocal organisations, you're seeing it in small media organisations like Navarra Media and other places across the UK already, and you're seeing it in Amsterdam, in Holland, in Europe, but America especially is leading the way. They have got 20 large independent media organisations, and those are the ones that are powering, for instance, Bernie Sanders currently, because the mainstream media will not give Bernie Sanders any good coverage whatsoever. Now, I'm not saying that media has to be political, but what happens, as the Young Turks like to say, is facts are progressive. So if you're willing to present facts, commentary, everyone on the internet nowadays can fact check things. So it's hard to present the level of bias. It's maybe not bias. It's often been described as, you know, the British press has always taken an interesting editorial line to engage its readership. So whether that's the Daily Mail, the Guardian, the Telegraph, it's always been clearly partisan, but, you know, as a part of a rambunctious debate. But that's not good enough any longer. People are looking for...
I don't know what you're quite getting at there, because I certainly see it as very London-centric. I think of it as the London media that's doing all the national and international coverage.
You're right, it is very London-centric, and that's a great tee-up to say, look, you know, our organisation is based in... we have members in London, but also in Bristol, Manchester, Glasgow. The country we live in is not just London, and in fact, you know, even the people who are living in London feel disassociated from it now. You see it with politicians, you see it with all other parts of the establishment, but you see it with the press and their unwillingness to question certain shibboleths. And it's why people like Nigel Farage get so much support for saying, you know, North London liberal elite, because everyone does feel disconnected from that. I think the press are so wildly disconnected that even when The Guardian does things like diversity recruitment, they end up getting two white ladies, you know, who are over the age of 30. They're not recruiting young people. They're not recruiting people from black and minority ethnicities. They're not recruiting working class people. There are no entrance points for those people in the current media. And if they do get in, they know what the rules are when they get in.
Okay, so your model, members might pay you for premium content. Well, what, give us an idea of what kind of stories you'd be covering for free and what people would have to pay for.
The free stuff would be anything of worth that was newsworthy. The premium stuff would be specific exclusive interviews. It would be, you know, it wouldn't be any of our investigations will always be fully available. That's what we want to get out there, our investigative journalism and anything we're aggregating.
So when you're talking about exclusive interviews, you're talking about YouTubes of celebrities?
Yeah, with celebrities, you know, with this, you know, Frankie Boyle or John McDonald, or, you know, whether it's political people or, you know, interesting people, we'll put up a portion of those interviews, you know, say a clip and say, here, this is very interesting. If you want to get the whole interview, you've got to join up. But more importantly, as I say, what you see with, say, Wikipedia or you know, a lot of models that work on this is the basis is I drop them a tenner because you say, this is fantastic. This is a fantastic service and I'm happy to drop a bit of cash into. And that sounds airy-fairy, but the thing is, the market research is there, and that is how modern tech companies work, and we need to think like modern tech companies, because that's how people are interacting with the world and information. They're the people who shape our access to information.
Well, personally, actually, I wouldn't donate to Wikipedia, because I've seen quite a lot of biased editing, and they have basically a failure to correct erroneous edits and things like that. Their system for appeals, if you want, is almost non-existent, and I use another site called Wikispooks. But I mean, this is the great thing about the internet. As soon as it looks like something starts to be controlled by the establishment, something else almost mimicking it pops up. But anyhow, so getting back to your model, are you actually working from home then?
Yeah, I'm working from home, you know, out and about. We've managed to raise funds through various grants and little bits and bobs, do work on the side, but mostly, yeah, through grants. And you can do comment and analysis from home, but, you know, what's great is that we've got good journalists in the organisation who go out and they're doing investigative journalism. They're doing journalism that actually other people don't have the time to do. So one of our journalists, Cam Sandu, who broke the story about the FCA and the whistleblower, you know, because it takes a lot of time, it takes a lot of resources. Well, we're willing to put that time in. We've got people who'll go out, they'll find the stories, and we're lucky to be connected to people across the country that do.
Well, there's also another question about this kind of investigative journalism, and that is that traditionally in Britain it was done by the big television networks and ITV networks like Granada, Central Television, people like that, that had massive budgets with staff of maybe 30 people working on one programme, including a full-time barrister. But you surely can't actually match that.
Our plan is going forward in the next year, we've decided to come up with an app that will be called Real Funds, and it will enable people to fund investigative journalism. People will put, much the same as they would to editors, they'll put a pitch together saying, this is something I want to chase down. It may take a year, and this is how we're going to help fund it. You know.
Well, I noticed that Byline Media, I don't know if you've come across them, are doing a similar sort of thing, and that expose about John Whittingdale came from that. So people say, yes, I want to see a bit of effort put into standing this story up up and shoving it out to the national press. Is that the sort of thing you're looking at?
Absolutely. And also, another thing that was talked about, you were talking about the Bristol Cable. We've worked with the Bristol Cable, the Salford Star, and a lot of great local, radical, independent media sources. And one of the things we were talking about is doing independent investigations coordinated across the UK through these independent media organisations. So we bring them together, we put money in a pot, and we share it out. So if there's something that has national significance, say it's something to do with housing, for instance, you know, that there are particular housing interests that are actually similar in Bristol as they are in Manchester, Peel Holdings, maybe, for instance, who are a big housing company that own developments in both areas and have been caught doing some pretty dodgy stuff with councils. We can coordinate that across the country, utilising great journalists that are already out there. But yeah, as you say, that, you know, that you see it with Byline. It's fantastic stuff what they're doing. The Centre for Investigative Journalism, the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, people are realising we need specialist investigative journalism and that people need to be paid for that. There's some great people like Anthony Lowenstein, who's worth, you know, following and checking out. And he crowdfunded a year's work on following disaster capitalism in Papua New Guinea, for instance. And there's quite a few examples like this. So
We had a discussion, I think it was about 18 months ago, talking to some of the people who were working on those big old investigative shows, which were doing, you know, big exposés, which had enormous ramifications, some of them. And really, there's nothing like it anymore in terms of finance. I mean, you're talking about having to fund a team of maybe 15 people, probably for best part of several months, including legal counsel. I mean, you're talking about something like £500,000 to fund one half-hour investigative documentary, insurmountable for a new media startup.
Absolutely. No, it's true. And in fact, we had a discussion on this. Real Media published a discussion between myself and Aaron Bastani from Navarra Media, where we discussed the future of the BBC and what he suggested, and I concur with him. We can do so much, and I think we can set the agenda, new media. We can create a new model of doing journalism that I hope will grow and grow and grow. But certainly in the short term, that is not going to be anywhere near good enough, and probably not in the midterm either. What we need to look at is the BBC, its funding. And when we're talking about changing the BBC, which Whittingdale is doing, we need to go exactly the opposite direction that the BBC are doing, certainly within journalism. You know, can we use the huge budget the BBC does have to support more independent journalism, to support more independent journalists, investigative journalists? There certainly are large pots of money there. If we see that as a public good to be used by all for the benefits of all, instead of it being a political football to be kicked about by various governments, that is potentially a future. But yeah, I mean, currently, in the short term, investigative journalism of that sort that you're talking about, the prospects look bleak, and it's a sad loss for this country. We need to step up to the plate.
So how do people find and follow what Real Media is up to online? I suppose it is only online, isn't it? We can't watch you on the television or anything like that.
No, you can't watch us yet. You know, someday soon we'll get there. You can find us at realmedia.press. You can find us at realmediagb on Twitter, or our Facebook is facebook.com/realmedia. So you can find us at on Facebook, Twitter. You can find us on Tumblr, SoundCloud, iTunes. You can find us at Real Media. And, you know, at the moment, we're doing some good work. But what would be great to look out for is our launch in October. We're going to have some truly special stuff, some groundbreaking investigations to release, some really special contributors, and a brand new app that we've managed to get quite considerable funding for that we hope will change the way that news is presented in this country.
So why does this all matter?
Why does it all matter? We need information to exist in a functioning democracy, I think. There's been a real closure of that information, and we get little peaks into getting the necessary information, but often the debate is within a very narrow band. And I think it's very important to widen the debate, to give more people more access to information that's relevant to them, to the functioning of this democracy. And, you know, hopefully that can help us build a better world. I think it's the only way. We can't start building a better world from an uninformed position, and we've got a lot of huge challenges ahead of us that we need to tackle, I mean, right now.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Well, my name is Jane Hersey, and Breath in the Dark
was not actually written as a book. I wrote a series of issues that I wanted my husband and son to understand why I was taken into psychotherapy, and how my childhood and early life had led me to having a lot of emotional problems. From the age of six, I was born in the Jewish community in Manchester, and from the age of six I was left to care for a mother who was suffering from depression, eating disorders and diabetes, which resulted from her psychological problems. My father had left, and because the Jewish community valued men and not women, my mother was blamed because my father left, and she was ostracized by her family. So even though I lived in the heart of the Jewish community with a lot of family surrounding me, I never met any of them. Well, met one.
But, I mean, how can some psychological problem lead to a medical problem such as diabetes? That just sounds impossible.
Well, no, it's not. It's very possible. I mean, stress, depression, eating disorders, you know, eating disorder led to my mother being diabetic. I'm in my early 60s now. I had an eating disorder and I have a very sensitive stomach. So, you know, your psychological state can definitely impact on your physical well-being. I mean, people who are drinking alcohol to deal with stress, I mean, they're going to end up with physical problems. So it's not really unusual.
With Breath in the Dark, take us through some of the highlights or lowlights of that. I mean, what do you think is in there that other people may find echoes with?
Right, well, the thing that academics find of interest in the books, and it is being used by universities and academics, is the fact that when I left school, I couldn't... had no way of writing a story because I'd missed so much education because I was looking after my mother. Now, what they find of interest is the fact that I don't write based on anything I learnt in school. I write based on my emotions and my immediate experiences. So what they've said to me is that, you know, some of the academics have said that for many years we've worked with people who have suffered trauma, and the one thing they have in common is that they cannot articulate that. But I articulate the trauma by default because I didn't know how else to write. So as far as the books go, I think it gives a good insight into the devastating effect of being a child carer, of having to look after an adult, a parent, when the roles become reversed.
Okay, so you say the books, Breath in the Dark. What are the other books?
The other one's Full Circle. That actually starts when I'm left to care for myself. I'd left Manchester. I was in no fit state. I couldn't wash, I couldn't bathe. My coping mechanisms were one of neglect. So I found comfort. Because I'd been neglected for so many years, I actually found comfort in not washing, not bathing, in having skin infections. And I couldn't hold down a job. I got into a very bad relationship. I got pregnant straight away. And it was very abusive. I stayed in that relationship for 18 months until I was really in fear of my life and the life of my baby. And I left in the middle of the night. And there was no support at all.
Now, one of the most important things that we think of nowadays that social workers at least have at their disposal for vulnerable youngsters are children's homes. Did you have any experience of those? And if so, what do you make of them?
Well, the majority of children that go into care homes or who are in care suffer from mental illness. That's not because of just the adverse background. It's because of the ongoing stress. Children's homes are not good places to be. And there's no public outcry about this because the media presents vulnerable children as being bad. So if children go into care, it can only be because they're bad. And because of that, the public have very little interest. I mean, obviously, children are taken into care because family situations break down. You know, parents may be ill, many different reasons. And more children are being taken into care now because of austerity cuts. Families are under pressure, families are breaking up, and children are being taken into care. But it's a terrible, terrible situation because they're pushed from pillar to post. Very rarely do they have a regular social worker. And worse than that is that the system doesn't acknowledge the trauma that they're going through. So they, as I was completely traumatised. I was just treated as though I had no intelligence and dismissed.
So what was your actual treatment within the children's homes? Were you cared for there?
Cared for, no. I mean, on several occasions I was sexually abused. There was food and there was a roof over your head. The nurse, the staff were known as nurses, so there was no, everything was, you were kept at a distance just by virtue of the fact that you had to call them nurse. There was no relationships, no understanding of what you were going through. And as I said, you were very vulnerable because, as is today, you know, you're vulnerable to being abused.
So how are you sexually abused under the noses, apparently, of these nurses?
Well, on one occasion, it was there were students who were coming to help, foreign students, and this was a female from Sweden, because it was in the Jewish community, and these were Jewish children's homes and what have you. It wasn't under the noses. I mean, she was female. She took me to her room and sexually assaulted me. On another occasion, it was another female nurse. This was in a different children's home. Now, this I was 13, and this is actually in the book that I was being, at the age of 13, I was being washed in a bath. I was being bathed by a nurse. And I wasn't actually being washed, if you see what I mean. But the thing is that, you know, a 13-year-old girl shouldn't be being washed by somebody. You know, maybe somebody could, you know, look on to make sure everything was okay, but certainly not being washed. But it's, you know, when you say under the noses of people, somebody takes you into a room, you know, other people who aren't paedophiles probably don't assume that anything bad's going to happen. You know, what can I say? You know, people find the way into these jobs where they're dealing with vulnerable children.
So do you think poverty plays a role here too in making children vulnerable? Because it doesn't sound as if they're getting the protection, particularly, you know, your experience there.
Well, no, I mean, poverty is an enforced imprisonment for anybody. Very few people get out of poverty. And the majority of children who go into care, who are being dealt with by social workers, are going to be from poor backgrounds. Because, you know, if you have money and, you know, a situation arises at home where a parent goes into hospital, you know, you're probably going to have the extended family looking after them. So children in poverty are extremely at risk. And I read something not long ago that because of austerity cuts and poverty, there's a 40% increase in youngsters self-harming because they don't know how to cope with poverty, and schools, local authorities are cutting back their funding to help vulnerable children because of austerity. So it's, things are actually regressing. The welfare state, which was the only very meagre thing that people had, is being destroyed, and nobody's doing anything about it.
Well, one group that is the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, even if it's only in informing us as how bad it's getting, Jane. Yes. They've just come out with a report that's saying that there's over a million people in Britain are now destitute. And when, by destitute, they define that as that they cannot afford basic essentials such as food, heating, clothing or toiletries, toilet paper, basic things like that. So certainly things aren't looking too good as regards... people actually being able to pay for the basic things that they need in order to live. Obviously a big increase as well in evictions. Now, I wonder what you make of that and how it's, you know, the sort of wider effects of society.
I personally find it disgusting. I spent a lot of time on Twitter, you know, trying to tell people to, you know, vote for a government who wasn't going to carry on austerity, who was going to realise, you know, the value of welfare. And even at the height of the welfare, my story was in the height of the welfare system, and it was still, you know, welfare is subsistence. The media portray it as being something there that, you know, enhances the life of people. It's subsistence to stop them from being destitute. But now we have a situation where people with mental illnesses are being sanctioned of the benefits, and they're, you know, mentally ill people. There's a rise in homeless mentally ill people. Well, this is disgusting, really. Absolutely disgusting. Welfare should be ring-fenced.
Also, I mean, worth pointing out that the High Court's just ruled that the government's sanctions regime is illegal, breaks the law. That is to say, cutting somebody off and living with absolutely no money to live on is apparently illegal.
This government have legislated. So, I mean, for example, with the NHS and social care, they've legislated so they no longer have a duty to provide care. So, you know, I've forgotten what the original point was, but, you know, we now have a government who is distancing themselves from people's needs. Sorry, just repeat that other point that you mentioned.
Yeah, I know you've written about eugenics. I wonder what that is. And it's one of those words that I'm never quite sure what it means. I think it wasn't it something to do with the Nazis? And you think that this might have some relation to... this idea of you know, having people that simply are utterly destitute.
Well, that's right. I mean, I've actually got a link that a psychologist in Sweden sent to me, and it's a very relevant link, and it says that eugenics remains a background influence in teaching psychology and psychiatry even today. And what eugenics is, and this is what is being practiced by this government, it's the notion that, you know, people are criminal. They're criminal and they're less than human if they are disabled, if they are poor, and that society doesn't owe them anything. Society's done enough for them, and now it's time to take that funding away, you know, and just let them go to the wall, because... The eugenicists think that if people haven't got the strength to become wealthy, then they should just be left to die because they're of no value, and they will only contaminate the gene pool of the rest of society. So that is, you know, that's what's happening now. People with disabilities, people living in poverty, they're having everything taken away from them. And when you take everything, when you take little away from people who have got nothing, then they are going to become destitute. They are going to die.
So as someone who's Jewish yourself, I mean, what lessons are there from the past about what to do about all this?
Well, the only thing that you can do is hope that, you know, people will vote for people who don't want to carry on this legacy. Welfare was brought in for a reason, and, you know, to vote for a government, which people have done, that wants to destroy welfare is really saying, well, anybody who is vulnerable in society can rot. And this is what we're seeing, you know, an increase in destitution, homelessness, and even Amnesty condemned this government for their attack on disabled people. So, but sadly, there's no political challenge to it. There should be uprising. There should be, people should be out on the streets demanding an end to all this.
So I suppose, I mean, the thing is that you've got a Conservative government who knows that the people who are suffering at the hard end here may be particularly destitute, just simply don't have the resources to even get a roof over their head sometimes, let alone organise to have some sort of political change.
Well, that's right. But you see, well, yes, and this is where they are clever. These people are actually being taken out of the voting system as well. I mean, they've messed around. Cameron has messed around with the voting processes in parts of London, so that about a million people in London have lost the right to vote. And they know that if people are alienated and disenfranchised, they're not going to want to vote because they're depressed. You know, it's a very clever strategy that they have.
Well, you're painting a pretty worrying picture of eugenics and a serious erosion of any kind of real democratic checks and balances. How do you think we'll break it, or will it have to get worse before people do something?
Well, it will have to get worse, but my worry is that we have unions, we have an opposition political party, and nothing's happening. There's no challenge to it. You know, I find it absolutely appalling. We've become a sort of I'm all right, Jack, as long as I'm okay. Why should I have to pay my taxes, you know, to help more people more vulnerable? But a lot of people are finding that they're becoming vulnerable, and they're probably finding out what it's like not to have support. So.
Okay, Jane, can you just remind us of the titles of your books and how to get hold of them?
Yes, Breath in the Dark and Full Circle are available on Amazon. A lot of UK libraries actually have the books in stock as well. But they're in e-book, obviously, e-book and softback.
That's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast has been broadcast on community radio stations in Bristol, Swindon, Preston and St Albans. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Barry Wynn, also author of Breath in the Dark, Jane Hersey and Thomas Barlow from Real Media. Also studio engineer Dave Pazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. And anyone can contribute. Contact us through People's Republic, Stokes Croft, who are just off Jamaica Street. You can call them on 0117 909 6897 or visit them on the web at prsc.org.uk. So, that was Dialect. And I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Until the same time next week, goodbye for now.
Sweet summer angels over the sea, please come down, fly and low for me. One time I trusted a stranger, 'cause I heard his sweet song, and it was gently enticing me, though there was something wrong. But when I turned, he was gone, blinding me. His song remains reminding me he's a bandit and a heartbreaker. Oh, but Jesus was a crossmaker. Sweet silver angels over the sea, please come down, fly and low for me. He wages war with the devil, a pistol by his side, and though he chases him out windows and won't give him a place to hide, he keeps his door open wide. Fighting him, he lights a lamp. In fighting him, he's a bandit and a heartbreaker. Oh, sea. Please come down, fly the woe for me. I hear the thunder come rumbling, the light never looks so dim. I see the junction get nearer, and danger is in the wind and either rose. Looking grim, hiding the eye, flee desire to fight the beast. Time I trusted a stranger, cause I heard his sweet song, and it was gently enticing me, though there was something wrong. But when I turned, he was gone. Blinding me, his song remains, reminding me he's abandoned and a heartbreaker. Oh, but Jesus was a cross maker.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's show, we look at issues of war and peace, past to present, from the Cold War to the so-called War on Terror. We're joined by independent journalist David Swanson, author of War is a Lie. We'll also take a look back at the massacre at Kent State 46 years later. We're joined by Laurel Krauss of the Kent State Truth Tribunal and attorney Michael Kuzma, who recently filed a FOIA lawsuit against the FBI to investigate further possible COINTELPRO actions at Kent State from May 1970. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we look at issues of war and peace, past to present, from the Cold War to the so-called War on Terror. And we're going to be joined by several great guests that are going to give us insight on these issues. Later in the program, we'll be talking about the 46th anniversary of the Kent State shootings. But first, we're joined by independent journalist David Swanson. And here is Peter to introduce David to you. Peter?
David Swanson is an author, activist, journalist, and radio host. He's director of WorldBeyondWar.org and campaign coordinator for RootsAction.org. Swanson's books include War is a Lie. He blogged at DavidSwanson.org. David, welcome.
Great to be here.
You know, David, it seems that we've evolved into a world of permanent war. The war on terror is endless. It is justified partly because of 9/11, but also because of expanded military action worldwide from U.S. and NATO and resistance to that in many places. How did we get into this mess, and how can we get out of it?
First of all, we should make a distinction between a war being justified and a war being counterproductive. Every time a top U.S. official retires, they blurt out that it's not working, that they're generating more enemies than killing, that you're never going to kill your way out of this. So you have a war on terrorism that predictably has been demonstrably increasing terrorism for years. So if you're going to get out of that, you're going to have to try something different. And trying something different does not require going outside the bounds of human nature and physical possibility and so forth. Over 90% of humanity right now is represented by governments that put radically less into war than the United States. 99% and more of people in the United States have nothing to do with participating in the military. The top killer of U.S. troops remains suicide, and there is yet to be a single reported case of PTSD from war deprivation. So the idea that this is somehow normal and natural and inevitable has to be overcome. And then we have to look at what we could do instead. And, of course, by investing in disarmament and transition to peaceful industries and actual humanitarian aid and diplomacy rather than more of what created the problem in the first place, we can get out of this mess much more easily than we imagine.
David Swanson, on warisacrime.org, not long ago you had an article by Gar Smith with actually a pretty telling headline. Obama admits U.S. military policy responsible for terrorist attacks in Europe. And basically the comment here is that Obama is making a public admission that U.S. foreign policy, war policy, military actions are directly linked to the spike in terror attacks against Western targets in Europe and the U.S. Can you comment on that sentiment and how completely backward that seems to be overall?
Well, I think the comment that Gar was looking at, who writes great stuff, by the way, was President Obama saying, as we squeeze ISIS, or ISIL as he calls it, in Syria and Iraq and take away their strength and their territory, they are going to lash out in European cities and other places in the West, and this is just to be expected. Well, then why do it if it's to be expected? But I think the broader point is that taking on ISIS militarily has been strengthening ISIS and generating support for ISIS within the West and within the so-called Middle East and elsewhere in the world. And when ISIS was created, it very quickly began putting out films pleading with the United States to attack it. And President Obama's initial response was, well, we won't attack it on the ground, but we'll attack it from the air and we'll arm arm and train people against it, which will help give it weapons and so forth. And this, when you had the commentators on MSNBC celebrating, hooray, Obama's not giving ISIS what it wants. It's only giving ISIS its second choice in the world of what it could have to be attacked by the United States from the air, which is predictably going to make matters worse. And then you're going to see a move to put U.S. troops on the ground, because you always escalate what's been making matters worse in order to make them even worse. And now you have so-called non-combat troops engaged in combat with ISIS in Syria and Iraq.
David Swanson, it's also the case that we see the Central Intelligence Agency and the Department of Defense funding competing groups in places of the Middle East, as if it's a proxy war where we're fighting ourselves, another grand contradiction that warfare gives us.
Yeah, this is really beyond the typical mess in which you have U.S. weapons on multiple sides of a war, which really has become the norm, with the U.S. being the top weapon supplier to the world and to the Middle East and to poor countries. So that, you know, people think of these regions as inherently violent and sort of blank out any awareness of where the weapons come from, as we think of people in U.S. elementary schools as inherently violent, forgetting to pay any attention to where all these guns come from. But this is beyond that. This is troops being trained and supported by different branches of the U.S. military machine going after each other. You know, Department of so-called defense forces fighting and killing so-called CIA forces on the ground in Syria. I mean, it's an incredible mess, and most people in the U.S. public don't seem to understand that the primary reason that it's this sort of mess is that the priority for the U.S. government is overthrowing the government of Syria, whereas the priority for the U.S. public, that has much of the U.S. public so scared it can't think straight, is destroying ISIS. And these two goals are at odds with each other. So people have to, you know, start paying a little more attention to what the U.S. government is actually interested in rather than what they're interested in and assume it must be interested in.
David Swanson, wouldn't you say that even destroying ISIS is not going to end permanent war or permanent war on terrorism, that that's just an escalating process with chaos kind of as the end result? And then even Bernie Sanders was saying that he would continue drone strikes against ISIS and they have to be destroyed. Is there anybody running a Democrat or Republican party that has a way of ending permanent war?
No, not that I have ever heard of. Congressman Kucinich was voted out by the military suppliers of a rival Democrat when two districts were merged in Ohio. There are, you know, a couple of dozen Congress members urging better policy on Saudi Arabia, where U.S. weapons with U.S. military complicity are slaughtering families in Yemen. There's nobody talking about actually moving away from endless warfare. You know, ISIS is not going to be destroyed, not by an attempt to quote-unquote destroy ISIS, which has been strengthening ISIS and at the very best would replace ISIS with a similar group by another name. What needs to happen is to disarm ISIS, disarm the region, provide actual humanitarian aid at far less cost than what it's costing to make the United States further hated and despised in that part of the world. And that's going to take, you know, a completely different approach. You're absolutely right. Every candidate, now there are apparently two Democrats and one Republican left, but even when the fields were larger, has identical approaches as far as they've told us. They all want to, quote unquote, destroy ISIS.
Does that speak to kind of a governmental desire for permanent war? Certainly advantageous for people in the war business and the military machine, but also advantageous in terms of maintaining a mentality for a police state, protecting the people in this country that go along with the post-9/11 police state agenda. How do you feel about opportunities for changing any of this down the road?
I think the U.S. public has shown some indications moving in a better direction. You know, I'm on this book tour with this updated second edition of my book, War is a Lie, where I look at the past 5 years of U.S. public response and lack thereof to war lies. And in some ways, we are in a much better place. And resistance to lies about chemical weapons attacks and the need to engage in a massive bombing campaign of Syria in 2013 was really stunning and encouraging. And resistance to the demand to attack Iran rather than forge a nuclear agreement with Iran last year was remarkable and encouraging. But the incredible evaporation of any capacity for rational thought that happened when these ISIS videos came out in 2014 or so of, you know, white people, Americans, being killed with knives, which is, you know, supposedly so much more frightening than nuclear weapons, that was incredibly discouraging. And so I think, yes, you have a permanent war profiteering industry in Washington with ever greater capacity to fund campaigns through what other countries call bribery and corruption, and we call campaign contributions. But I think you also have this understanding among politicians that people are scared to death of ISIS, and you cannot possibly say anything other than we will destroy ISIS. It's the only politically acceptable thing to say. And once you say it, then you can get in the same war on both sides and on the opposite side and arm ISIS, and nobody cares, and nobody's going to pay any attention as long as you've said that. So, you know, we have to get the public over this hump of, you know, irrational fear of an organization that has killed and has the capacity to kill far fewer Americans than, you know, armed toddlers or any long list of serious diseases and avoidable accidents. We've got to get beyond this incapacitation of fear.
We're speaking with independent journalist, author David Swanson. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. We'll continue our conversation with David Swanson after this brief musical break. Stay with us.
He had never done nothing but build to destroy. You play with my world like it's your little toy.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're joined right now by independent journalist and author David Swanson. You can learn more about David Swanson at davidswanson.org. Also one of the co-founders of warisacrime.org. Again, check those sites out online. David Swanson, I'd like to turn some of the attention both to historiography or history, historical analogs, and media coverage. When we're dealing with issues of war and peace and U.S. empire, these are long-standing, and certainly post-World War II, the United States is on permanent war footing. What in your mind has possibly remained the same on one hand, but changed on another, vis-a-vis, say, Vietnam and Cold War, and the way that the U.S. sort of moved its agenda in that era, and how media covered it with the way that it's gone since 9/11. Could you comment on that at some length?
Yeah, I think, you know, there were good, well-meaning liberal people who imagined that when the Soviet Union collapsed, all of the wars would collapse and we would get a peace dividend and the United States government would cease all of these endless wars that had been justified by the commie threat. And, of course, that was to misread the entire operation, which was always about dominating the globe, for which communism was not actually a motivation. And so since the collapse of the Soviet Union, you've had the same war machine, but with a different package of excuses. And that package of excuses has included the threat of terrorism, which is far better than communism because it can never go away. But it also has included increasingly humanitarianism, the idea of police rescue operations, philanthropic wars, wars for the good of humanity. Never mind that, you know, there's not yet been an example of one that benefited humanity. And every time they want a new one, they point to one that didn't didn't happen, you know, in Rwanda, where, by the way, nobody would ever have benefited from being bombed. We have to bomb Libya because Rwanda. And then you get to Syria. We have to bomb Syria, not because Libya. Don't look at Libya. That's a disaster. We have to bomb Syria because Rwanda. And, you know, and so this argument for humanitarian wars has picked up a sliver of U.S. public support that otherwise has dropped off.
Well, it's quite Orwellian, David Swanson, and Bill Clinton was arguing the same thing in the 1990s and surrounding Yugoslavia. Candidate George W. Bush said he wasn't going to have any of this kind of interventionism and nation building, and then, of course, 9/11 took place. So, I mean, the narrative here is quite troublesome, and your commentary about U.S. support, meaning population support for these kind of so-called humanitarian inventions, it exists. There is some support for it, although one might argue it's manufactured by corporate media and the deep state.
Well, of course it is. You know, U.S. public opinion on anything is manufactured by the corporate media, and that's beginning to slip with the growing strength of independent media and online and international media among young people on various issues, and that especially on Israel-Palestine, and that's very encouraging. If that resistance to Israeli wars becomes a broader resistance to wars, including U.S. wars. But it also has become so normalized that it's not even a question of media coverage, but of lack of media coverage. I mean, I go around on this book tour to events and ask people, raise your hand if you can name the seven countries that our current president has bragged about having bombed, and almost nobody can do it. Through these drone wars and special forces and wars without Congress and wars without the UN and wars without public debate, the idea of endless war has been so normalized that the possibility of ending it is just off the radar screen, and people avoid even knowing where the wars are happening now.
Well, David Swanson, one of the analogs I was looking at, too, is, I mean, if you go back to the 60s, there was an actual anti-war candidate. We do have anti-war candidates today, but they're third party and the corporate media ignores them entirely. So we've certainly seen in your language the normalization of the permanent warfare state and the acceptance of so-called humanitarian intervention. That seems to be sort of a mighty challenge that we all face.
Absolutely. But I think, you know, the fact that there were anti-war candidates, even in big parties, and pretended secret plan to end the war candidates in big parties during the war on Vietnam era, was a reflection of a broader change that was a result of a massive popular activist movement that was creating those situations, just as the peace movement in the early 2000s overwhelmingly won the 2006 elections with the top demand in everybody's exit poll, get out of Iraq. And then the Democrats turned around and escalated in Iraq. And Rahm Emanuel said, we're going to keep it going so we can run against it again in 2008. And people said, oh, okay, and shut down the movement and didn't continue what had been built, which was actually quite impressive and changed the culture in a significant way and was the biggest factor in 2013 in stopping that bombing of Syria, with Congress members saying, I don't want to vote for another Iraq. That the badge of shame that prevented Hillary Clinton from winning a primary 8 years ago. But the memory fades, and this is why we have to keep public awareness of war lies and war disasters and resist the mythologizing of the U.S. government that is, you know, now has a multi-million dollar campaign to celebrate the war in Vietnam. President Obama's declared the war in Korea a victory now. They're building a World War I monument of all lunacies in Washington, D.C. We have to wage this battle over history if we're going to have any ability to stop future wars.
David Swanson, we're well aware of pending environmental disasters in the world, but often we don't link the U.S. military to environmental pollution. Certainly, it's the largest polluter in the world. And a piece you wrote entitled The U.S. Just Bombed Germany, you talk about the 100,000 unexploded bombs still in Germany, and how those will blow up occasionally and kill people. And, of course, there's the issue of depleting uranium. So permanent war means permanent environmental damage. Could you talk a little bit about the bombs still left in Germany?
That's a key key element of the argument we make at worldbeyondwar.org for abolishing war, that it kills primarily through the diversion of funds that could be used for humanitarian aid and for environmental protection, among other things that we desperately need major funding for, and that it is the top eroder of civil liberties, the top destroyer of this, that, and the other, including the natural environment. You can drive your car around all year. You're not going to do the damage of a single hour of a military jet. The military is the third biggest polluter of U.S. waterways, the top creator of Superfund disaster sites, the top consumer of petroleum, would be ranked 30-something in a list of nations, were it a nation, in terms of petroleum consumption. I mean, it is the top threat to the natural environment, and the big environmental organizations won't touch it, and that's an enormous weakness for the environmental movement. We have to get to the point where civil liberties groups and environmental groups and other types of lobby groups for which war ought to be their top opponent is something they're willing to challenge. That, you know, we have to have this sort of change, as we've seen in the area of gay and lesbian rights, where corporations are willing to take a stand. Most corporations, non-war profiteering corporations, would benefit from peace, but they're afraid, culturally, they're afraid to take a stand against war. So we have to do that.
David Swanson, you hit on something there, too, in terms of the idea of coalition building, standing together, pushing other groups, other activist groups, environmental groups, to understand the problems of rampant militarism and empire and how it impacts their own interests and their own primary concerns. You know, FCC, former FCC Commissioner Nicholas Johnson, who wrote the foreword for Censor 2016 this past year, reminds us, he was author of Second Priorities, and reminds us that regardless of whatever your first area of concern is, if your second area isn't media reform, independence of media, and fighting, you know, censorship, you're likely to gain little ground in your first area. So building this kind of coalition and awareness, particularly in your example that you just gave with environmental groups, is quite significant. As, you know, the military polluter story was one of the top censored stories 4 or 5 years ago with us, that Sarah Flanders, Mickey Z, a few other people were writing about, certainly you're writing about it. But I think you really hit on something, that there needs to be some momentum that really pushes other activist groups to work in concert around these related areas in order to create a synergy for actual change.
I totally agree, and I agree with several of those arguments, including Nicholas Johnson's, that if you want to do good, you have to work on this area. I think you can say that about the media, you can say that about election reform, you can say that about the natural environment, and so on, which points to the fact that we need a multi-issue coalition, and we will all be stronger if we have a multi-issue coalition. But in terms of media and communications reform, I find it incredibly, incredibly frustrating that if I go on CNN or MSNBC and I speak a little bit too out of line, I never hear from them again for years. And I go around the country and I speak to groups of college students, to groups of peace activists, to other assemblies of people, and I get the exact same questions, you know, the same stupid questions about World War II, about the Civil War, about Rwanda, you know, and I answer them at length and I move on to the next event, and it's the same thing all over again. If we had a communication system that worked, I could say what I have to say through television and reach all of those people at once, and many, many other people who have many, many other important things to say could say them and we could all hear them, rather than, you know, having to make our way around a country of hundreds of millions of people, room by room.
Well, and here we are, David Swanson, room by room on air, right? You have a radio show. We're doing the Project Censored show. This is another version of the room by room, and we don't get access to the plutocratic megaphone, the six corporations that own 90% of the media in the United States. So literally, there needs to be grassroots movements, citizen journalists, educational efforts that are literally transforming the media system and the way that it operates. And you're likely aware at the end of May, Ralph Nader is putting on an event called Breaking Through Power, Historic Civic Mobilization, of 4 days of, you know, really speaking truth to power and breaking through corporate and deep state blockades of power. And one of the efforts there is to try to build sort of a multilateral coalition called Voices of media outlets that are working in a sort of a consortium to bring all of us kind of together to build our own large platform that's a counter-hegemonic information block. And I think that that's something that you're also speaking to, because we also, like you, speak in rooms around the country, but we do lack that ability ability to speak to major parts of the population simultaneously, and we can't just simply expect corporate media to be reformed to allow these voices to be on, because it's counterproductive to their own profit interests.
Well, obviously that sounds wonderful, and if there's any way I can help, let me know. And of course, the work of Project Censored in highlighting the shortcomings, the glaring immoral shortcomings of the corporate media, has been tremendous. I think there's little we can do of more importance than building a better communication system. And there are encouraging trends in terms of use of the internet as well as radio shows, and in terms of people accessing international media, media from outside whichever country they happen to be in, which almost always does a better job of covering that country.
David Swanson, that's also why we want to call attention again to your work, davidswanson.org, warisacrime.org. Later in May, David Swanson will be in the San Francisco Bay Area. He'll be speaking several different dates. You can go to davidswanson.org and see all the dates and times. He'll be in conversation with Daniel Ellsberg, Norman Solomon, Cindy Sheehan, but David Swanson, it's again so important that we are doing these things, and that, you know, you are traveling around and speaking to people about the very significant themes that you raise in your work. And again, we hope people go and look more carefully at it, davidswanson.org. Peter, do you have a concluding remarks for David Swanson?
Well, David, Chris Hedges and a number of people, David Talbot for one, certainly have talked about the need for social movements that are grassroots, occupied-style democracy movements like are happening in France right now. That young people really do resonate to that. And as you talk with young people, you say, okay, there's no easy answer. Voting isn't going to solve the problems in terms of choices. But at some point, people are mobilizing, and that really scares the jabezas out of the power elite and the deep state folks. I mean, they infiltrate these groups like crazy, but if people are mobilized really in mass ways, that we can perhaps see some relief down the road.
Well, no question. We do have to overcome, as you mentioned, the idea that elections are all there is, or any significant portion of what there is, which is really a new and bizarre belief that all you can do is vote or cheer for a candidate and nothing else, when, you know, the entire panoply of nonviolent tools is available and is what has always changed the culture. We have to change our culture in significant ways, and we have the ability to do it, but we have to get away from dumping all of our resources into elections when the system is completely broken, put some of our resources into reforming that system, and get away from the cycles of, you know, messiah expectation and then despair and disillusionment as we invest false hopes in candidates and then go through regret over that. We have to focus on policy and nonviolent mobilization and look at how incredibly powerful it is and how much more powerful it would be if a few more of us got involved.
Building movements, not candidates in election cycles, is definitely the long-term way to go. If we look throughout our history, we know that that's how social movements tend to go, and they do happen, and they are possible. I believe one or other of various movements are taking place right now as we speak. And very quickly at the end here, I'd be remiss, of course, if I didn't at least try to tease you into some brief commentary on the current bread and circuses of the election. And of course, Trump aside and Hillary Clinton, but even Jeremy Scahill rightfully recently dressed down Bernie Sanders' foreign policies and pro-war kind of policies. And it really is the case that if you're looking only at the two parties, things are pretty boxed in, David Swanson.
Well, yes, of course they are. At RootsAction.org, we spent a good deal of effort many months ago now trying to push Bernie Sanders towards some sort of a decent and specific foreign policy position, and really got nowhere. You can go to RootsAction.org and see the list of successes that we've been a part of. I mean, it is possible to move people through online activism, especially in combination with offline activism. But on Bernie Sanders and foreign policy, forget it. I mean, he is locked in to what, in comparison to Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, is, you know, the coming of the age of Aquarius. But in comparison to a sane, sustainable foreign policy or international standards of upholding peace and the rule of law, you know, he's a crazed militarist, because this is what has become the norm in U.S. politics. And as we speak, the corporate media is pretending that that primary is over and Hillary Clinton has beaten Bernie Sanders, which is just patently false. But if at some point that becomes the case and you're looking at Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, I really don't think you can reasonably vote for either one of those people. I mean, you have to vote for another candidate outside of those choices. Look at HillaryIsANeocon.com. If you want Hillary's foreign policy, HillaryIsANeocon.com, you can't get worse.
She's racking up quite the right-wing accolades these days.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Donald Trump is talking very nonsensically and inconsistently against war and intervention because he knows Hillary's got the whole We Want More Wars group locked up. I mean, she's their candidate. And we can't continue this lesser evilism to the point where the two candidates are this disastrous. You have to break out of that and start putting your energy and your resources into something other than a broken election system and into reform at the local, state, and global levels.
And for those of you that want to learn more about how that's happening and what to do and how you can get involved, we encourage you to go to davidswanson.org. His most recent book is a second edition of War is a Lie. And at the top of the davidswanson.org website, it says, "Let's try democracy." We couldn't agree more. David Swanson, thank you so much for rejoining us on the Project Centered program. We look forward to talking to you again, and please keep up the fantastic work that you do.
You too. Thanks very much.
That was a discussion with independent journalist David Swanson. We will continue the Project Centered show with a discussion about the Kent State Massacre 46 years later. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We continue today's program, our theme of war and peace past to present, from the Cold War to the so-called War on Terror, with a focus on the Kent State Massacre, which passed 46 years recently. And we're joined by Laurel Krause of the Kent State Truth Tribunal. We'll also be joined by attorney Michael Kuzma. Laurel Krause is a longtime activist around the Kent State Massacre. Tragically, her sister was slain there by the Ohio National Guard. Laurel Krause is a founder of the Kent State Truth Tribunal and has been really seeking, as many associated with that event, seeking the truth of what happened that day. Laurel Krause also contributed and I helped co-author a chapter on the Kent State Massacre about civil rights and murder for the Censored 2013 book. And Laurel Krause, we are happy to welcome you back to the Project Censored Show.
It's an honor to be here again.
And Peter, please introduce Michael Kuzma.
Attorney Michael Kuzma is a sole practitioner in Buffalo and has long viewed the law as being a tool to bring about social, political, and economic change. For over three decades, Michael has fought to make government more open and accountable through the use of the federal and state freedom of information laws. He's litigated a number of FOIA cases and currently has lawsuits against the CIA, the FBI, and the New York State Department of Corrections. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you again, both of you, for taking time with us today here, 46 years after the massacre at Kent State in Ohio. Laurel Krause, let's start with you and catch up a bit. Some folks may be out there wondering, why are we still talking about Kent State 46 years later? And, of course, that was a big focus of the chapter that we did in Censored 2013 with the revelations of forensic expert Stuart Allen. Could you just briefly catch up our listeners as to what's happened and how you've taken this to the UN and beyond as sort of a footing for us?
Yes. New evidence showed up with Stuart Allen in 2010, and that's what you were referring to. He's a forensic expert. He took a tape from a window ledge of a student at Kent State University. The recording was done during the shooting, and he pulled out of it an order to fire, along with some stuff that was going on 70 seconds before that order that kind of pointed to the FBI being involved in the massacre. And so that evidence showed up right as we were doing our Kent State Truth Tribunal. We were collecting testimonials from original participants and witnesses in 2010 on the 40th anniversary, and throughout 2010 year we did three tribunals. And so that evidence showed up. It was separate from our work, but it was wonderful evidence. It pulled up this order to shoot that had been denied by the government for over 40 years, and also that very concerning element where it looked like COINTELPRO and FBI were involved in instigating and firing the first shot at Kent State, per se. And so as we did the testimonials, it made sense to also work with Stuart Allen, and he was actually one of our last testimonials that we recorded in New York for the Kent State Truth Tribunal. The evidence that he found was just so compelling, we really needed to have our Department of Justice look at it, but in 2012 they refused. And so that's one of the reasons why I wrote that article with Mickey. And when they refused, the Department of Justice refuses, there's no recourse. So at the end of that year in 2012, I actually wrote to the International Criminal Court at The Hague to try to take it there. And we were rejected a few months later. It wasn't in their purview. It just wasn't appropriate for them because the U.S. isn't even a signatory at the ICC at The Hague. And then I located a phenomenal lawyer named Jamil Dakwar. He had just won a lawsuit against the CIA in the European Human Rights Court. It was for rendition and torture, and they won the court case. And so I saw that in the news the day it hit, and I called up the lawyer that won it, and he answered the phone and identified myself as Allison's sister working on Kent State Truth Tribunal. And he said, "I've heard of your tribunal," which was just one of the best comments I've ever heard, because we're just a little baby organization here, but we've got an important cause. And it goes beyond just a civil rights or beyond my sister's death. It's about the right to protest in America without fear of death or harassment or even arrest, as well as accountability issues. And then the making of amends when things are wrong. None of this has happened. And so we pursued this, and we got it in with Jamil Dakwar helping us out, and he suggested that we take it to the UN at the U.S. Periodic Review, which we did in 2014. And at the hearing for the U.S. Fourth Periodic Review on their human rights record over the last 5 years, two members of the committee brought up issues related to Kent State, command responsibility, what happens when deadly force is used, what are the levels of investigation, et cetera, and what happens when new evidence shows up 40 years later. And the Department of Defense responded the next day saying that Kent State was killing and murder. And this is the first time we heard that out of their mouths. And they also said that the statute of limitations has lapsed. But since then, we have found out that if someone is protesting, if their civil rights is prevented by death, the statute of limitations never expires. So we just keep moving forward here. And Michael Kuzma's case is very important because no one's ever looked at the FOIA records. It seems as if it's pristine ground. It's never been looked into. It's, government's never really had to answer for any of the things that they did, and they've not allowed us a view into what they did on purpose. And so that's what we're working on, and that's where we're at right now.
Thank you for that quick overview, Laurel Krauss, to remind our listeners the significance of this and the bigger picture of it. And certainly in terms of the historical record and the significance and importance of getting the historical record right for victims of state violence. And Michael Kuzma, let's turn to you. On May 4, 2016, this year, an attorney there, Irwin, filed a complaint on behalf of yourself, suing the FBI under Freedom of Information Act to try to get records concerning one Terry Norman, or Terrence Norman, who was an FBI informant and former police officer. It has been shown that shots were fired from his gun at Kent State University May 4, 1970, prior to the guards shooting the students. And again, this, it's quite possible, led to a hail of gunfire coming from the guardsmen, or an order to fire, as forensic expert Stuart Allen has suggested he found on the so-called Struva tape. And this led to the deaths of Allison Krauss, Jeffrey Miller,
Miller, Sandra Scheuer, William Schroeder, the wounding of nine others. This is a very serious thing, and Michael Kuzma, you've made some public statements about this. Let's hear what your thoughts are about the significance of this case now.
I learned about Terry Norman's involvement through Neil Young's website, Neil Young News, and I found it quite fascinating because I represented Leonard Peltier, Native American activist and political prisoner. When Leonard was arrested in February of 1976, he was also arrested with an individual by the name of Frank Blackhorse, who was actually not a Native American but had been masquerading as a Native American. His name was Frank DeLuca, and he's still a free man in Western Canada, and I believe and still believe he was an informant. So I saw parallels between Leonard's case and this Terry Norman incident. Also, I currently represent Leslie James Pickering. He has a bookstore here in Buffalo called Burning Books. And in 2012, Leslie and the bookstore, they were both targeted by two FBI informants. So I thought this Norman episode was quite intriguing. So what I did is in June of 2015, I submitted a FOIA request to the FBI for all records regarding Terrence Brooks Norman, also known as Terrence Norman, and I wanted records regarding his involvement in the killing of four Kent State students. So the FBI in July of 2015, they write back and they say, you need a release from Norman in order for us to process your request. I treated that response by the FBI as a denial, and I filed an appeal with the Office of Information Policy, which is a component of the Justice Department. My appeal was subsequently denied, and I brought this lawsuit with the help of Dare Irwin, a local activist attorney. That's my hope, we can pry loose some records regarding this shadowy character and find out if he was sent in by the FBI to trigger the actions that were taken by the National Guard on May 4th, 1970.
Well, Michael Kuzma, we've certainly seen problems with the Guard and the ROTC building. We have eyewitness testimony on the ground saying that the lighting of the ROTC building was highly suspect and was possibly part of a plan of provocation. We are well aware now, after the breaking in Media Pennsylvania 1971, of the COINTELPRO, or counterintelligence program of the FBI. And in part, what we're looking for here, is there any significant connection between specific COINTEL program activities, plans, discussions, whether from the Nixon administration or Governor Rhodes at the time, who was up for a primary reelection, and the actions that actually took place at Kent State? And that's something that you're looking for in these records. Is that correct?
That's correct. Actually, the director after Hoover denied that the FBI was involved with Norman, a letter to a member of Congress. However, Clarence Kelly acknowledged to Senator Birch Bayh that Norman was, in fact, an FBI informant. And there's been public revelation that an FBI agent by the name of Bill Chapin was actually one of Norman's handlers. In fact, Chapin asked Clarence Norman to appear at the anti-war rally in May of 1970.
That's pretty amazing. Laurel Krauss, it just seems to be, and this terminology has surfaced already, this shadowy kind of character and the potentially nefarious connections as an FBI informant, seems that Terry Norman has gone 46 years without really attracting the attention he might deserve.
So that's the way that they want it. He had to do a deposition in 1975. What happened is my parents led the lawsuit at Kent State to sue the government. We were prevented from suing the government because Ohio is a sovereign state. And so they had to win the right to sue Ohio in the first place. It was denied. It was appealed. It was denied. It was appealed, you know, on all the levels. And then it went to the United States Supreme Court in 1974. And my father's lawsuit won at the U.S. Supreme Court. So he was allowed the right to sue the governor and the Ohio guardsmen, et cetera. They could name them. So 5 years later, that's when Terry Norman's deposition happened, because we weren't allowed to get his deposition unless we were able to sue him. The deposition is a lot of I can't remember anything, and it kind of a smart aleck response throughout it. But what has been evident every step of the way is that the government has been acting to conceal him. They've been protecting him, and he continues with that in 2016.
Let's go back to what you said earlier, Laurel Krauss, when you said that, and again, this is in no way to minimize the terrible tragedy at Kent State 46 years ago, but you certainly alluded to this being bigger than this issue in terms of civil rights, the rights to protest, the significance of so-called Occupy movements. We're coming up on a fairly contentious two-corporate party election coming up here in the fall, and the Republican convention to be held in Cleveland, Ohio, not far from Kent. One can only imagine that there will be significant kinds of protests there. And one of the reasons I know that you still persist in this is that you're really trying to call attention to the significance of our First Amendment rights to assemble and petition government for grievances.
Yes, and they are continuing to do this. The Occupy movement faced the same things that Kent State faced. The issues of Kent State go beyond civil rights, though. They go beyond in the sense of the state-sanctioned killings and targeted assassinations of people of color, protesters, young people. We have a long history of the government, police, military, covert people shooting, killing. There's no credible investigation. There's no amends made. But I do want to talk about COINTELPRO a little bit, because the COINTELPRO program that was operating during Kent State was called the New Left. That was their project name for it, and it was to target communism on campus. It wasn't about protest. It was about communism. They brought up this symbolism of communists so that they could fight the communist menace at Kent State and the infiltrators that were coming in. We don't know what other projects were involved with the New Left, but we know that the COINTELPRO was going after the Black Panthers. We know that they were horrible to Martin Luther King, you know, trying to tell him to commit suicide. There was even some stuff with the KKK and COINTELPRO. But the New Left, which was all of the anti-war protesters and all the students and everyone for peace in America, they were targeted, but there's no evidence of it anywhere. I mean, can you name a New Left project for COINTELPRO? Can anyone?
Free speech movement here in California was deeply penetrated, and names have come out of FBI informants, and there's a book on it now that's quite good. And I think many people assume, and I would imagine Michael might agree with this, is that those tactics of infiltration, of agents provocateur, of hidden members of organizations who are informants to the police state, are all part of a package that's ongoing even to this day.
Correct.
I'd like to remind listeners that you are listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips, and we are going to continue our conversation about the Kent State Massacre 46 years later with Laurel Krauss and Mike Kuzma after this brief musical break. Stay with us.
I've had enough of reading things by neurotic psychotic pig-headed politics. All I want is the truth.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're speaking right now with Laurel Krauss of the Kent State Truth Tribunal and Michael Kuzma, an attorney who's recently filed a FOIA lawsuit against the FBI regarding potential COINTELPRO connections of Terry Norman at the shootings May 4, 1970. And just before the break, Laurel Krauss and Peter were talking a little bit about COINTELPRO, about infiltration, and of course about the problems of how we find out about these things. Historically, we found out a lot about COINTELPRO during the Frank Church hearings in the 1970s, post-Watergate. So we do know that these things are afoot. We are, of course, still trying to learn more about these historical developments. And Michael Kuzma, that leads me to you to talk about something very important. You mentioned burning books in Buffalo, burningbooksbuffalo.com. Certainly allies of Project Censored definitely support what they do. Could you talk to our listeners? Could you tell them about the FOIA process? I think this is very significant, that it's something that isn't just some esoteric, very difficult kind of thing that regular citizens can't seem to navigate. And I know you've worked on this, and at Burning Books, they have a great FOIA section that actually is kind of a how-to to help people really understand how they can get access to documents. Can you talk a little about that?
Yes, we had burning books. It's Leslie Pickering, his wife Teresa, and then Nate Buckley, another activist who's been targeted by the authorities. We actually have a group called the Buffalo Committee Against State Repression, and we have monthly meetings. We bring in speakers. We just had Lynn Stewart speak at the bookstore. But we've also given classes on how to use the Federal Freedom of Information Act. Most states have a comparable law. Here in New York, we have the Freedom of Information Law, or FOIL. But it's a very, very simple process, and it's an underutilized tool both by activists and journalists. But anyone can make a request. You don't need special training. You don't have to be an attorney or legal assistant. And on the Burning Books, it's burningbooksbuffalo.com, we have a FOIA section. We have sample FOIA requests and appeals, and we actually have a lawsuit. But the way the law works is you can make the request. In theory, the agency has 20 working days to respond to the request. They're supposed to either deny it or provide the sought-after information. The dominant feature of the law is disclosure, not secrecy. If an agency doesn't provide the sought-after material, you have appeal rights. And our primary focus is the FBI. So the request goes to the FBI in Winchester, Virginia. If that request is ignored or denied, you can appeal to the Office of Information Policy, which is a component of the Justice Department. In theory, once again, the agency has 20 working days to either overrule the initial denial or what have you. What happens is with both the FBI and Office of Information Policy, they usually don't meet those deadlines. The law also provides you with a court remedy. You can bring a lawsuit in one of four places where the requester resides, where he or she has a business, the District of Columbia, or where the records are located. So in the case here with Terry Norman, I'm the requester. I'm here in Buffalo, so I have a right to sue either in the U.S. District Court for the Western District of New York, or I could have brought suit in the District of Columbia. And in this case, I made the request. It was denied. My appeal was denied. We've exhausted our administrative remedies. So the case now has been assigned to Richard Arguera, who's on senior status, and the government was served with the summons and complaint, and they have 30 days to respond.
So in your experience legally, this may be a different situation, but I recall Laurel Krauss talking about the Justice Department and the investigation that Dennis Kucinich was looking into the issues of reopening investigation, and they took over a year to get back to Dennis Kucinich to tell him that they weren't going to reopen the case. And in this case, regarding a FOIA lawsuit, you're saying that they have 30 days to reply.
Yeah, typically in cases against the federal government, the government has 60 days, but under FOIA, you have a 30-day response period. So we'll get a response. They'll either admit or deny. And it's a very simple complaint. It's three pages. It just shows why the court has jurisdiction, why venue is proper here in Western New York, and then it just makes the accusations. I made a request. It was denied. I appealed. That was denied. And then I just make some claims that I have a right to prompt access to these records. And so on. One of two things I believe will happen. The government will either say, hey, Kuzma didn't have a release from Terry Norman. We can't release this material because it would be an invasion of Norman's privacy. Or they may come back and say, we'll give you public source material. There's several ways this may go. The third is what they should do is, since Norman's status as an FBI informant is out there, what they should do is process the material, and that's what I'm going to fight along with Mr. Irwin vigorously for. But this case is going to move along quite quickly. We'll get the answer. We'll file, depending on what they do, and there's going to be a local U.S. attorney assigned to the case here in Buffalo, and they'll have people from the Justice Department in D.C., and then you'll have FBI attorneys. So the Buffalo assistant U.S. attorney will pretty much take his marching orders from D.C.
Michael Kuzma, thank you for sharing that. Certainly at Project Censored, we also want to follow the case through end of May and early June and to update listeners more about what's happening, and we'll do so also online at projectcensored.org. Peter?
Michael, would you make an assumption that activist groups, environmental groups, peace groups, even locally based, were very aware of a group in Fresno, a peace activist group that was infiltrated by their sheriff's department, are often infiltrated, often watched and observed? What can they do to protect themselves from this? Can they do blanket FOIA requests to their local police?
Yeah, we've done that here in Buffalo. Buffalo's in Erie County, and it's probably widespread in California and other states, but we have these license plate readers. And here in Erie County, we have a right to use the state's Freedom of Information law. We just provide our plate number, and we can get copies of every time our plate or vehicle's been captured. Now, a lot of times when we are at Burning Books for either film screenings or listening to Lynn Stewart or Jeff Haas or whoever, we notice all these police cars coming by with their license plate readers. So I just submitted my FOIL request for my plate number, so I'm anxious to see how many times my vehicle and plate was captured in front of the bookstore. But with respect to Nate Buckley, another activist who's a proprietor of Burning Books, he was actually targeted in April of 2011 for participating in an anti-war protest and front of M&T Bank, and we found out there were a lot of shady characters involved with that. They were also involved with the Occupy movement. There was one individual who was at this protest taking pictures with his so-called girlfriend, but a year or two later, this same individual ends up on the Hannity program talking about a million-person Muslim march, if I'm not mistaken. He was very sketchy, and I believe he was working with the authorities. We had a Occupy Buffalo movement, which was in front of Buffalo City Hall, which was under surveillance by the U.S. Coast Guard, of all things. This guy set up a competing Occupy movement, which brought heat on the original, if you will, Occupy Buffalo movement.
Well, Michael Kuzma, that's, again, all very relevant information. And when we look at the history of COINTELPRO, you're describing that running up through the present. And it's very important context to have moving forward. And if people want to learn more about the FOIA process, you can go to burningbooksbuffalo.com, and it's linked on their front page. Laurel Krauss, I want to come back to you as we conclude this segment. Of course, the Kent State Truth Tribunal website is truthtribunal.org. Your writings are also at Mendo Coast Current. What are your concluding remarks here after the 46th anniversary of the Kent State Massacre?
May 4th, 2016 was a phenomenal event. What happened is my cousin, Jennifer Schwartz, she represented our family. All the four are represented. But the keynote was Samaria Rice, who's Tamir Rice's mother. And so there was a very large Black Lives Matter presence at the 46th at Kent State. I wasn't there, but I did watch the live cast of it, and I got to see a lot of photos. It was enthralling to see people of color all over the campus sitting together, and even Samaria Rice called for peace between the races in her talk. She also mentioned that, what is it about civil rights? I mean, our First Amendment right, if we're not allowed to protest without the police harassing us, it really doesn't exist in America. And she called for our civil rights to actually start counting. I'm with Samaria Rice. I think that it is time for us to come together, and it was wonderful to witness it.
Well, Laurel Krauss, again, I can't thank you enough for your efforts to really seek truth and justice surrounding the events that tragically took the life of your sister and three other young people, you know, again, that weren't even really involved around or near the National Guard that murdered these people. And Michael Kuzma, we certainly thank you for your tireless efforts to find out what's really going on and using FOIA and using the tools that we have as citizens to try to really uncover and make more transparent and accountable this government of the United States. So Laurel Krauss and Michael Kuzma, we thank you for joining us on the Project Censored show today, and we certainly will be coming back to discuss with you an update on these issues.
Thank you for having me.
And I wish everyone peace.
Thank you both kindly. We'll certainly be checking in with you soon. And that does it for the Project Censored show today. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips on Pacifica Radio. Special thanks today goes to Anthony Fest, our producer, also to Erica Bridgman, our engineer. The Project Censored show airs on 35 stations around the United States from Maui to New York. Archives can be found online at projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us and follow updates about Project Censored on our Facebook page at Project Censored. We'll see you next time. Stay tuned for Terra Verde. Think of a
crepit about criminal minds, political ties, habitual eyes, alibis, skies, another guy's democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burn bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for why. Taxing all the prisons and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prison, fill the capacity, citizens, and the ties for the master thief. Divine conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Climate scientist Kevin Anderson on the unforgiving math for staying under 2 degrees. Two numbers haunted the climate negotiations of COP21 in Paris in December 2015, 1.5 and 2 degrees Celsius. Finally, the vast majority of the world's countries agreed that global warming may not go over 2 degrees and that we really ought to stay under 1.5 degrees to save the island states and low coastal areas that are already flooding at the current 1 degree Celsius warming. Kevin Anderson translates those numbers for us. He's professor of energy and climate change in the School of Mechanical, Aerospace and Civil Engineering at the University of Manchester. He's deputy director of the Tyndall Center for Climate Change Research. He gave a radical on-the-spot analysis of COP21 right there, on location in Paris, to Kevin Kainers. Kainers' radio blog, The Elephant, focuses on climate change. In part one of this program, Anderson explained the carbon budget. In 2011, the IPCC said that no more than 1,000 billion tons of CO2 may be emitted between 2011 and 2100 to save the life support system of the planet. Kevin Anderson took apart that formula and said, since 2011, we already emitted 150 billion tons of CO2. That's 15% of the whole budget in 4 years. At current consumption rates, it would take under 20 years, not 90 years, and the budget would be spent completely. At this point, emissions are rising rather than going down. The 2015 emissions are 60% higher than they were only a quarter century ago. Anderson said, it's about what happens in the next 5 years that matters. We need a rapid and deep reduction bordering on 10% a year if we talk about stabilizing climate by the end of the century. However, politicians and some scientists claim that we will invent technologies that remove carbon from the atmosphere, and therefore no urgent action is required now. In the alphabet soup of abbreviations, you will hear about BECCS, Biomass Energy Carbon Capture and Storage. That's the so far elusive promise to find a way to extract the already emitted CO2 from the air and store it underground. What Anderson calls a Dr. Strangelove plan. Here's Professor Kevin Anderson.
There's a prospect of a future technology which will suck the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. That is now embedded in almost all of the main models that are informing governments. The detailed climate models, not the physics models that look at climate, but the models that combine that physics with economics and behaviour and politics, and these sort of what are called integrated assessment models. These models are the ones that inform the policymakers. They're called cost-optimising models. They work out what's the cheapest way of holding to 2 degrees centigrade. And they almost all show the same thing, which is the technology we don't have now, if that comes into place in 2050 to 2070 and sucks the CO2 out of the atmosphere, sucks the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, then we don't have to make such big changes today.
We're pinning our hopes on a technology that doesn't really exist yet.
Without a doubt. That is the underpinning of almost everything being discussed in Paris. All the discussions about the INDCs, saying the INDCs are 2.7 degrees or 3 degrees, all of that is premised on assuming we can suck the CO2 out of the atmosphere a long time in the future. No one even talks about it now. That technology that does not exist is just assumed to work. And it's been completely normalised. A lot of climate scientists are, particularly the sort of the natural scientists and some of the physicists, are really very concerned about this, but they're not quite so vociferous yet in voicing that concern, though that is changing. Here it's changing in the big climate change conference from the scientific community that was in June in Paris, actually, this year. There are lots of people there really genuinely deeply concerned about these integrated assessment models and their reliance on this technology that doesn't exist a long time in the future. Dr. Strangelove, I don't know if you've ever seen the film, but I was thinking of it as a Dr. Strangelove technology. It may work, but the idea to assume that it will work is really very dangerous.
And what do you think the effect of this built-in assumption is? Is it dangerous that everyone has this built-in assumption?
Well, it's incredibly dangerous because what it allows us to do is effectively use an incremental adjustment to business as usual. It allows us to carry on, smile at these events, pat each other on the back, and leave here on a plane to go home once we've got the taxi to the airport and live in our biggest homes. Because negative emissions in the future, we just turn the dial up and that'll suck the CO2 out. Okay, we have to make some adjustments. We have to gradually move towards renewable energy and maybe eliminate fossil fuels in the system in the next 70, 80, 90 years that some people have been talking about and from the IPCC have been talking about as well. You know, this doesn't fit at all with a 2-degree C framing unless you can suck the CO2 out of the atmosphere. So it fundamentally changes what we're prepared to talk about here. And even the idea that people say, well, the INDCs are in line with 2.7 degrees, you know, that is repeated here in many venues. Yet the people who are saying that never understand, or virtually never understand, that behind that is an assumption that huge amounts of carbon dioxide are going to be sucked out of the atmosphere in years to come. And a very common technology for that, planned technology, is something called BECCS, Biomass Energy Carbon Capture and Storage. And they're going to plant places like, you know, they could be huge. Some of these scenarios assume places as big as India or larger, planted with biomass, harvested every year, transported around the world to power stations, burnt in power stations, the carbon dioxide captured, liquefied, pressurised and put down into a reservoir somewhere under the ground and held there for 1,000+ years, safely without leaking, more than 1,000+ years, safely without leaking. That's the premise. That's what we're assuming is going to occur. At the same time, we're trying to feed 7 to 9 billion people on the planet. The aviation sector thinks it's going to use biomass for flying the planes. The shipping industry thinks it's going to use biomass for powering its ships. The car industry is already using biomass, and the chemical industry thinks it will use biomass for chemical feedstock. So you've got all the sectors thinking, oh, we're going to use this biomass, this magical fuel that's going to save the world, you know. And people need to sit back and think, we've got a round planet, we've got changing temperatures, we've got 7 to 9 billion people, we've got, you know, we have this changing climate. Is this in any way realistic? And lots of the people now, lots of scientists are saying, no, it's not. And there are some papers now coming out suggesting this looks incredibly dangerous set of assumptions to build our current policies on.
Is this what you mean when you talk about how there's a bias even within the scientific community of kind of tweaking the numbers so that we get a conclusion that is palatable, that we can digest?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, there are a number of ways we do it, but that is the most powerful one that is used. Another one is that we assume global emissions will peak very early. So quite a lot of the scenarios in the IPCC assume global emissions have already peaked.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yes, yeah, a lot of the scenarios. The UNEP GAP report, and a lot of the scenarios there have assumed global emissions have already peaked. So, you know, we have this one where we're going to use lots of negative emissions. We also assume a very, very early peak, or possibly a peak in the past, which is more challenging. there's often a very naive assumption on the uptake of technologies, how rapidly they can penetrate the system. Now, they can do a lot with technologies, but we have to be more realistic about how they can be factored in and what that would actually mean. You know, do we have enough people trained to do these things? Can we move them off other things that they're doing and move them onto, you know, pushing forward a very low-carbon agenda? I just don't think people really think this through on a sort of system-level basis. They do it with their algorithms and with their computer models and their equations, and I think there's a real danger in that. I call it non-contextual. They don't really step outside and look at the world within which they live and say, how would you deliver that here in the next few years? But it allows us, by adjusting those assumptions, it allows us to fit within the current political discourse. And again, that's the one that you hear. You hear that sort of language, green growth. You know, we can have our cake and eat it. You hear that repeatedly. It's just rubbish, you know, win-win opportunities. There are some win-win opportunities here and there, but by and large, we're going to have to make such large changes that the way we would normally measure these sorts of successes in our society, you know, would not be successes. You know, that we would measure that as being not so positive. So things like economic growth, we will probably have to question whether that's viable in the short to medium term for the wealthy parts of the world. Certainly wealthy people within the wealthy parts of the world, that is unlikely to be viable. Well, almost certainly will not be viable in the 2°C framework. You know, people will have to take a significant economic hit. Their positional goods, the way that they see themselves in society, will have to change. Now, it doesn't mean we have to have a low quality of life. We can still have a very high quality of life. But those adjustments, at the moment, we would measure those things as not, or see those things as not being particularly positive.
I'd be curious what it's like for you personally to work in this area, especially without a lot of the comforting assumptions that other scientists or people in the environmental movement use. I imagine that can't be easy, because just thinking about that last point, well, how likely is it politically that the most powerful people and nations in the world are suddenly going to say to themselves, we can't grow our economies anymore?
Very few of them. And that's partly because we've become dominated by a particular group of economists. This wasn't the same 20 or 30 years ago. I mean, they dominate every facet of our lives now, whether that's in governments, whether it's in universities, whether it's in our schools. I mean, everywhere our lives are dominated by a particular way of looking at the world. But that's new. That is constructed. We don't have to have it like that. There are ecological economists out there look at the world differently. There's people like Herman Daly, very influential, used to be in the World Bank, Stiglitz of this world, or the Piketty of this world. There are people questioning some of these things. So it is being questioned a little bit now, this particular economic paradigm that we have.
But what is it like for you personally?
For me personally?
Because, I mean, you obviously have to contemplate a lot of scary scenarios.
Yeah. And there are two ways. Firstly, from a personal point of view, in terms of being isolated, I don't feel quite so isolated. I feel there are lots of other people now saying these sorts of things. Now, often they won't say them publicly, and they'll use a form of language which is slightly different to mine. I quite appreciate the fact that you have to have we all communicate in the way that we think is most appropriate for us. I do think it has to fit with the science. Some people might argue my language is slightly more colourful. I think the adjectives I use fit very well with the numbers. So I don't feel I'm misusing the adjectives. I think, you know, if numbers look dire, then I would use the adjectives that say it's dire. But other colleagues find that slightly harder to do, and they will, you know, use slightly different language. Nevertheless, I mean, the event that was at today, I think some of the colleagues on the stand, I don't think 5 years ago they would have said the things they were saying. And I hear that from not just from early career academics, I hear that from quite a lot of senior academics who are saying things that are really quite challenging for society. I mean, you know, as a very clear example of someone who's held up in high esteem in places like Germany and elsewhere across Europe, like John Schellenhuber now is saying things that, you know, are very difficult for our current economic framing of society. You know, you could argue the Pope's coming out and saying these things as well. So, you know, there are very senior people saying these sorts of things. The IMF, you know, pointing out the huge subsidy for fossil fuels. The International Energy Agency coming out and saying we're aiming for 6°C, that's our trend line, and that's with devastating consequences for the planet. The IEA saying that. There are established figures and institutions that are saying things that are fairly radical, as well as the sort of more detailed stuff that I and increasing numbers of people are saying. So it's much easier now than it was 2 or 3 years ago. 2 or 3 years ago, I found it very difficult. So it's not too challenging for me from that point of view. The way it is challenging is actually trying to live in a world where, I mean, the flying one is not easy for me. I think we should have to accept the fact it will not be easy. Academically, it's less of a problem. It doesn't mean that I spend a bit more time away from home than I would like to do, and it takes a lot more organisation.
And what about anxiety for the future?
I mean, there's a lot of that. Yes. And I think, but a lot of people in NGOs and elsewhere feel that as well. But it is a rich middle class person's anxiety. A lot of people have anxiety around the globe, and they're worrying about where the food comes from tomorrow, or what's going to happen to them 2 weeks down the line, or that huge flood in India now. That's what they're dealing with.
So I'm still contemplating the end of the world, essentially.
It is, but I'm not going to worry about my Western anxieties. I think I can deal with those. I think a lot of other people have got a lot more immediate anxieties, which maybe not the end of the world, but it's the end of their lives or their family's lives, or at least a reasonable livelihood. So, you know, I'll take that hit because I work in this particular area. I see these things. I don't find that a problem. But the personal things are like I have a lot of, I'm a keen rock climber. A lot of my rock climbing friends go away climbing for weekends or for the odd week here and there to Morocco or to somewhere in Norway for ice climbing in the winter. I can't join them because I just jump on a plane and off they go. So that has affected my friendships there. I have an uncle at home very close to who lives in Australia, a lovely man. I will never see him again. Now, that's not easy. He's old, not very well. I would love to see him. I've not seen him for 11 years. And I will likely never see him again. I can only talk to him or Skype him or whatever it might be. And that is not easy. So personally, that is very challenging. But if I go to see him, unless I can get there slowly, maybe if he's still around when I'm retired, then maybe I'll try and go to see him. But if I was to fly there, the emissions are so high from that particular journey, I think, well, that will have an impact on poor people living in Bangladesh. Now, I don't know which one it will be over there, but it will significantly add to the burden for these people. And I can't justify that. So therefore, I can't go and see him.
But couldn't you say that because you're working your whole life on climate change and trying to promote the types of actions required that then it's justified in a way?
Lots of environmentalists say that. Lots of my scientific colleagues say that. In fact, very few people don't think that. I mean, I found it very depressing. On the second day I was here, I talked to a really good scientific colleague of mine, an excellent scientist, and he said, I can justify flying here from a provincial town in the UK because I did good work on climate change. Yeah, I haven't met anyone who doesn't think differently. The business community thinks it has to fly and has to have a largest amount of carbon dioxide because it feeds into prosperity in our society, but allows us to buy more expensive renewables as they see it. The aviation sector thinks it's the exception, important for growth, cultural development around the world. Shipping industry, essential for moving of goods around the world. So there's two sectors that shouldn't be included, and in fact are outside UNFCCC, have not submitted any INDCs, and are under almost no control for their CO2 emissions. But then there's the climate scientists who think they should carry on because, hey, we're doing really good things. Where is this person that's going to compensate for everyone else's emissions? So I think we have to be very careful about this particular ruse that we use to justify it's a cognitive dissonance issue. We know deep down that's not what we should be doing, but that's quite hard to deal with psychologically, so we make out this point that we are the particularly important people. I don't think I'm that important, but I should be flying around the world to try and solve climate problems.
And you've, on that note, you also take a very negative stance to carbon offsetting. Can you explain why?
Yes.
Why can't I pay for my flight by planting trees somewhere else?
Yeah. Indulgences.
So you don't think the science behind it is
correct? No, I don't. There's quite a number of reasons against offsets, and I'm not completely opposed to them. So say you plant trees, you fly somewhere, you fly to New York to Paris to come to this conference, and in doing that you plant a few trees. Your flight is guaranteed to emit a carbon dioxide because you're on the plane. You've also sent a very clear market signal that says, please buy some more planes and build more airports, and those cannot be made low carbon in the future. And you're going to compensate for that by planting a few trees, which you hope will suck the CO2 up over some period in the future. Of course, that period in the future, how do you know that's going to happen? How do you know there's not going to be a movement in pests that mean those trees get killed by changes in climate and bring around new pests? That's happening in the UK. For lots of reasons, lots of trees are dying in the UK now. I'm not saying because of climate change, but because of changes in their natural environment, one way or another. How do you know that in 20 years from now, there's going to be some sort of problem with fuel in one part of the world where these trees have been planted? They get chopped down and converted into just fuel for people to use.
So it's the uncertainty about it?
Yeah, but the uncertainty is there. But it's more than just the uncertainty, because what you have done is put the CO2 in the atmosphere and sent a market signal to expand that particular high carbon form of energy. And what you've done to try and compensate that is plant a very uncertain tree somewhere else. So they're not comparable. That ton in the tree, which is very uncertain, is not the same as the ton you've guaranteed to have emitted, or the ton of CO2 that you're almost guaranteed to have embedded in the expansion of the industry that you've supported. The other problem is that people say, well, can we not just pay for a wind turbine or a solar panel elsewhere? I'm all for us doing that, but not as an offset. So imagine that. We fly somewhere, and we buy some solar panels for an Indian community, a village somewhere, wherever it might be, some poor village that didn't have power before. Great, they've got solar power. I'm all for that. They can access light, they can do extra reading, they can have a television or a radio. They have a television or radio, they don't get advertising on the television or radio, because now that's there. The advertising could be, buy a small petrol scooter so you can travel between the markets. Maybe you can get a small truck to move your goods from one market to another. Great, that's good for development. Not really opposed to that necessarily. But that now means that they're now driving the scooter rather than using the ox or whatever it was they were doing before. And your emissions are still in the atmosphere from your flight. So what you've done over a longer period of time is to help the other part of the world improve their development, and therefore increase their amount of CO2 emissions in the short to medium term. That's not an offset. You've probably increased the amount of CO2 emissions, so it's actually worse than doing nothing from a CO2 perspective. But that doesn't mean that I'm saying those people should not have a solar panel. I think we should not fly and we should pay for the solar panel. That's reparation. We are stopping them from developing the way that we developed because we think the carbon dioxide emissions will be too high. But at the moment, what we're saying, well, we want to carry on doing what we've done, as well as benefiting from the fossil fuels in the past. We're going to carry on flying and everything else, and we're going to pay the poor people elsewhere in the world to compensate for that. I think that at every level, scientifically, mathematically, and morally, it is reprehensible to be doing that.
So you'd say it's worse than doing nothing?
In my view, it's much worse than doing nothing, yeah. At lots of levels. They're not just the scientific way, mathematical way, in terms of carbon dioxide emissions, but also the moral framing that that is an appropriate thing to do.
You mentioned that you worked in the oil patch?
Yes, I left school at 16 and did an apprenticeship as an engineer in the Merchant Navy, working on tankers and gas carriers and container ships. And then later on, I did an engineering degree, and then I went to work in the oil industry. Basically, as a design engineer, designing offshore oil platforms, and then in the what's called the hookup and commissioning, the construction of the oil platform offshore, and then partly in the operation of the oil platforms as well. So that's my sort of engineering history. I was always interested in energy and environmental issues, right from being a child living next door to a nuclear power station where my dad used to work as a fitter, so I used to work on the reactor. And I was interested in those issues right back in the 1970s when people weren't thinking about climate change then, but we're thinking about alternative energy, it used to be called. So we're thinking about how would you go move away to alternative energy sources. It's a long history. All my life I've had an interest in energy, really, thanks to my dad. And for some reason I had an interest in environmental issues, and I don't know where that quite came from, but that persisted. Whether I was working on the ships or whether I was working on the oil rigs, I was always involved in trying to make sure they did things as cleanly as possible. So we didn't release CFCs, which were a big issue when I was on the oil platform, trying to see how can I restore the CFCs and put them back in the system when we're doing maintenance work. So I was always trying to look at it like that. And then I thought, this climate change issue came along. This looks really serious. Tried to understand the science. Thought I need to go back to university and find out more. And I've been working on it ever since.
What year was that?
I think it was in the early 1990s.
So really early on when it was...
Oh, yes, yeah. It was the very early days of sort of climate change being seen as a big... I mean, obviously people had worked on it before, but it was becoming a vogue issue. I was starting to read quite a lot about it. And I thought, actually, I don't know that much about climate change. I need to find out more. I did as much reading as I reasonably could that was available in 1990. But thought, no, I need to go back to university and find out a bit more detail. And so that's what I did, and I've been working on it ever since.
And was there like an article or something that you remember interacting with that really got you thinking or concerned about it?
No, I don't think it was. And actually, I don't think my life has ever really run like that. There's been one thing that's triggered, occasionally maybe, but generally it hasn't worked like that. It's a sense of something. So, you read bits and pieces and you think about it a bit more. I always think that thinking is very important. I argue that with students. Yeah. The first thing is not to read. The first thing is to think. So I was thinking about a lot of issues then and trying to read about it. And I came to a judgment that this is likely to be an important issue. And the studies I did at university when I went back again looked to me that this was a very, very important issue.
And you certainly made the right bet on that one.
Well,
unfortunately.
Yeah, yes, unfortunately. I mean, I genuinely wish the skeptics were right. I think I wish the skeptics were right much more than them. I would very happily pack up my job and go back to doing something else I would much rather do. I really miss my engineering. I really enjoy doing it. I feel now I've developed a sufficient expertise in this area that I feel I'm sort of obliged to stick with this area. I don't want to be doing this. I don't want to be in COP. I don't enjoy working on climate change particularly. I have some good colleagues, but it's not the sort of terrain that I feel particularly happy with. But I think it's a very, very important subject. And I'm lucky enough to have a set of expertise that has a role to play in it. So I feel some sort of moral obligation to work within this area now. But that's the way it is. I still count myself, I'm a lucky Westerner living a very comfortable life, so I can't complain.
Well, to end off, I'd be curious what gives you hope and resilience going forward, given all the... you've kind of given us a lot of bad news today, Kevin. So you're still working very hard on this issue. Obviously, you're not giving up. So what gives you resilience going forward?
Well, it's more of a moral framework, really. I mean, the science is all well understood, and as far as I can tell, it's completely right. I mean, we well understand climate change. We very clearly know why carbon dioxide emissions are going up in the atmosphere. We know from what sources they're going up, and we know that it links to temperature. All that stuff we know. But exactly what the temperature rise will be for the exact amount of carbon dioxide emissions, there's some uncertainty there. So that helps us. We also have an opportunity to make the big political changes that would be necessary. The door is slightly open on the science, the door is slightly open on the politics. There's not much hope of us pushing hard against any of these. But if we did push really hard, we might push them quite a lot further open, and we could perhaps then move to a different place, a different paradigm, a different way of thinking of these issues. And that's where my hope is, really, is that whilst that thin thread of hope remains, and it's very thin, if I was a betting person, the chances are that we're going to fail. But whilst it remains, it's incumbent on people like me to do my damnedest to try and make sure we bring about those sorts of changes, the necessary changes. We are already too late for 1.5 degrees C, and I know a lot of people are talking about it here, and I think I'm pleased that they are talking about it, and I've had discussions with my colleagues about whether that's a good or a bad thing, but I think politically, I think it's important that they're pushing hard for a lower temperature. I don't think you can scientifically achieve that now. I think it's beyond, I mean, our carbon budgets have been blown for 1.5 degrees C as far as I can tell. And that means that we're aiming at 2 degrees C, and that means a lot of people who have had nothing to do with the problem will suffer the repercussions of our profligate use of carbon and knowing profligate use of carbon. So we have effectively in the West, or the wealthy part of the world anyway, we've been like a meteorite that has hit the planet knowingly with a conscience. So, or without a conscience maybe, we've knowingly hit the meteorite, but without a conscience, perhaps that's a better way of seeing it. And I think that's wrong. I find that morally, you know, just not appropriate to do that. And if I have some ability to try to change that a little bit, then that's what I try and do. But it isn't one of false hope. I don't think we're going to succeed, but I don't know we're going to fail. And that thin thread, that thin difference between thinking and knowing is what keeps me working on climate change.
Well, is that what you mean when I saw in the talk that you said that it comes from dealing with just how bad things are that we'll get any hope if there is any to get?
Well, that was saying, that was the think, as I recall, that was saying that until we recognise how bad things really are, until we recognise the situation we're in now, so it's a bare assessment of the scale of the challenge we face. Because a lot of people say, I take away all this hope. I'm not taking away hope, in my view. What I'm doing is trying to offer real hope. You have to say, where are we today, exactly, precisely, bluntly? We need to understand the challenges we face. And then we can say, well, what can we do about it? But at the moment, we're not even prepared to accept where we are today. We pretend we're somewhere else already. So, you know, in Paris, we should recognise that I always say we need 20 minutes or 20 seconds to bow our heads in shame. We've had a quarter of a century of doing nothing about climate change. So all the great and the good turning up here, and people, academics as well, in our suits and our tweed jackets. Let's just us remember that we have fundamentally failed the poor and impoverished around the globe. We will have our failure will have resulted in the many, many deaths and certainly very many impoverished lives of poor people elsewhere who had nothing to do with climate change in terms of causing it. And I have to suffer the repercussions of our failure. And I do think a little bit of humility, a little bit of holding our heads in shame, and then standing upright, putting our shoulders back, and saying, "Right, what do we need to do?" That's how we should start. But we're not prepared to even do that yet. We're not prepared to acknowledge where we are and what we've done. And that's my point about, you know, hope only, useful hope only emerges if we're honest about the situation we face today, and we're not prepared to do that yet.
And last point, people who've been listening, you know, obviously you're saying we need to all reduce our emissions. Once people have done that, I mean, what else would you say people need to do?
Two things. First, I'm not saying we all have to reduce our emissions. I'm saying that those of us who are responsible for the lion's share of emissions have to reduce our emissions. Yeah, that's certainly not everyone.
It's probably, most of our listeners.
Well, maybe, yes, okay, I don't know your audience, but it may well be most of your listeners. Well, it's not only reducing their emissions, it's about reducing their emissions and arguing with their friends, their colleagues, writing to their politicians. You know, it is making the case way beyond just what they do themselves. But actually, if you don't do it yourself and argue it elsewhere, you lose credibility. So I think you have to demonstrate, you know, action yourself and make the case elsewhere. And the other thing, of course, is that we also have to argue for a rapid shift away from fossil fuels. Fossil fuels, I mean, the very blunt message from this, fossil fuels have to stay in the ground. 80 to 90% of all the current reserves need to stay in the ground if we're serious of 2 degrees C. So we have to be arguing for that. So the point I made earlier today, countries like Norway, the UK, and someone else made the point about Australia, these are countries with huge renewable energy opportunities, wealthy populations, and very well educated. They should be producing no fossil fuels. So the oil and gas in the UK should stay in the ground, no more shale gas in the UK or development of shale gas. The Norwegians should close down their North Sea oil industry, and the Australians should stop producing coal. We all know that it's fossil fuel use that affects climate change. It doesn't matter how many renewables you've got. If you're still burning the fossil fuels, then that's no good. So if rich countries like ours aren't prepared to do that, then we have no hope. So that's the sort of scale of change that we need, and it's incumbent on your listeners, I would argue, if they think climate change is important, to not only make the changes themselves about how they use energy, but to be pushing really hard for their governments to move away from a fossil fuel-based economy.
Well, Kevin Anderson, thanks so much for joining us.
That's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
That was the conclusion of an hour-long conversation between Kevin Anderson, Professor of Energy and Climate Change at the University of Manchester, and Kevin Kainers. Kainers blogs under the Elephant from Berlin. They met up in the hallway of one of the conference centers at the International Climate Summit, COP21, in Paris in December 2015. Thanks to Kevin Kainers for allowing me to broadcast his extraordinary interview. A slightly longer version is posted at his blog, The Elephant. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.com. www.ncbi.org, look at the newest programs, or the podcast page. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. Time of useful consciousness is an aeronautical term. It's the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for useful projects to rescue the planet and the plane. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. Today we're going to be talking about a great peace fighter, Daniel Berrigan. And he died at the age of 94 over the weekend. We're going to be speaking to Ted Schmidt, who listeners of this show will know as a veteran peace activist in Canada and who also was a great admirer and supporter of the Berrigans. I say Berrigans. We'll be talking about the other Berrigans, too. And after all this talk about peace, we will talk about the war in Syria. And we'll be speaking to Rick Sterling of Syria Solidarity Movement. So I think the two are linked. And in between, we may say something about May Day, which has just been... We had more excitement this May Day than we are used to. I think we're joined now by Ted Schmidt. Are you there, Ted?
I'm here, Phil.
It's good to hear you. This is a kind of a sad moment, but we're talking about a gentleman, a Jesuit priest, Daniel Berrigan, who was 94.
Almost 95.
Almost 95, and had he retired?
He never retired.
You're never neutral, and he never retired.
That's right.
Tell us about, what are your thoughts about him and your memory of him and
what
stands out?
I think he had an indelible effect on Catholics of that generation and peacekeeping in general. As you know, he came to prominence in May of 1968 when, for the first time in history, two priests were indicted for destroying draft records in Catonsville, Maryland. And this sent shockwaves. I mean, the two FBI guys, you know, the FBI and the CIA were famous for hiring Catholics because they could take orders. Yeah. One guy said when he arrested Phil, "I can't believe it. I got to find a new religion." It shows you, you know, that they were really plugged into empire, hardly the gospel. So when that happened, I was on sabbatical, about to begin my downwardly mobile life within Catholic education, and it sent a shockwave through many of us because, you know, we'd grown up in a pretty conservative church, pre-Vatican II, and then this incredible explosion of interest in power and dynamism suddenly exploded within Catholicism. And then here are these two priests who dare to take the Sermon on the Mount seriously, to become peacemakers, just not to sit back and be peace lovers. So that was my first exposure to them. I didn't know much about them, or if anything. Mm-hmm. And so it just went off in my universe. And reading some of the stuff that's out there now, in many Catholics of that generation, I mean, I think they had a profound effect on Catholicism in general, because we were moving out of a very tired academic and neo-Thomist way of looking at church. So in that sense, they were profound motivators of a whole generation of Catholics.
Well, let me ask you about that. You speak, of course, of a North American context, which was pretty conservative, but isn't it the case that he had gone to Europe and had met priests who were of a different stripe than we tend to view here?
Absolutely right. He had gone as a young Jesuit. As you know, the Jesuits are really the shock troops of the Catholic Church. They're the best educated, and they give their priests a wide berth. So he had gone in the 50s to France, and there he met the Catholic workers. And these were men who said, much like the present Pope, you got to have the smell of the sheep on you. You got to be where people are working and suffering. And so he saw these men who went into factories, much like our own hero in Toronto,
Dan Heap,
who was an Anglican priest, not too far divorced from Catholicism. And Dan worked in a factory for, I think, 17 years. So these people had a great effect. Sadly, it was shut down in the next pontificate.
Yes.
So you're absolutely right. He saw another vision of what priesthood was open to at that time.
Yeah. We're speaking to Ted Schmidt, who, by the way, has a wonderful website, Theology in the Vineyard, .wordpress.com. Please go there. Today there is a memory and reflection on Daniel Berrigan, which includes some beautiful words from the man. He also was a poet, and we're talking about a serious poet.
Very serious poet. He had 50 books written, many of them poetry, and a prize winner early on in his priesthood. And I think that's why, you know, his words are memorable. I mean, he couldn't write a sentence that didn't sing.
Well,
Kurt Vonnegut had a great line about him. He said, "Dan Berrigan is Jesus as a poet. You know, if this is heresy, make the most of it." So he was a great poet. And many people think of Berrigan, they always associate him with his older brother, Phil.
Yeah. And before you go to that, I just want to give a sample of this, and I might have taken it from you. I was just going around the net looking today. He said, I think it was at the time of burning. By the way, they used napalm. I'll ask you about that.
That's right.
To burn the draft records. But he said, "We are peace criminals accused by war criminals."
Yeah, that was the opening statement in 1968. And he started this statement off, which later became a play, The Trial of the Catonsville Nine. And he said, "Our apologies, good friends, for this fracture of good order, the burning of paper instead of children, the angering of the orderlies in the front parlor of the charnel house. We could not, so help us God, do otherwise." So he was making the links, of course, with the napalm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, here we are defending the poor, and for burning paper. So we apologize for the burning of paper instead of the burning of children.
Oh, my God.
And that was very, very powerful. But he was a hell of a poet.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no doubt about it. His poetry was very powerful. And, there's many, many books of it that I have.
Yeah. Well, let's do a little bit about his family. By the way, I'm noticing today they're saying, linking his name, of course, to his brother Phil.
Yeah.
Or Philip, I should say. I'm Phil. But there's another brother, Jerry, who
Jerry was incredible. I knew Jerry and his wife, Carol. Jerry was committed to peace, Nick, right to the end. He died about a year ago at 94. He was much loved in the Syracuse area. He was a community college teacher, beautiful human being. I mean, they're an amazing family. And I think a couple of the other brothers were pretty reactionary. But that's often the case.
They would have had to work real hard to keep up.
Yeah.
They didn't hold up their side of this.
Yeah, so, you know, they came from a hard scrabble existence in the Syracuse area. And what I didn't know when I got to know Phil really well is that in 42 or 43, he'd come to Toronto for university, the same university that I went to, St. Michael's College. Mm-hmm. And then he was drafted. And so at 19, he saw major fighting all through Europe.
He was decorated, wasn't he?
I don't know that he was decorated.
He was in combat, for sure.
Yes, he was in combat. And, you know, he said he cheered when the atom bomb went off.
Ooh.
He thought that was great. Well, you know, you're 20 years old.
Yes.
What do you know?
Yes.
And then he entered the priesthood and was sent to a very – he was part of a religious order that dealt with poor blacks, mm-hmm. and that transformed him.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was the more activist of the two brothers. And when the Vietnam War broke out, he went to Dan and he said, look, you're going to be part of this? Because Dan was kind of a pixie, a very gentle soul, hardly ever raised his voice. And Dan had to think about it. But he said, yes, I must come. But he couldn't do the hard time. He was very sensitive. Phil did 10 years.
Yeah.
I remember visiting him in Pennsylvania, and he broke a fast just because I was coming to visit him. I mean, to him, friendship was sacred, and the same to Dan. They were really people, to me, that gave Christianity and my own particular faith, Catholicism, mm-hmm. Great credibility. But they loved each other. They were as close as any two brothers were. I remember going up to Dan at Phil's funeral, which was something in itself, and saying, I know what it's like, you know, and condolences, gave him a hug. And, you know, he was just so bereft when Phil died. In 2002.
Yeah, I get the impression that's right. They were it was like a basketball team. One of them was the sort of the shooter, the one of them was the writer, and the other one was the, you know, get it organized and get it done.
That's right.
Great combination.
Oh, they were a tremendous combination, but behind closed doors, they were very similar. They were Irish. Irish German. I mean, they loved a good time. I remember when I first met Dan in 77, I went to a retreat in Pontiac, Michigan, and I remember coming down at night and stealing into the refectory because we were still hungry. Mm-hmm. And I was down there with Dan and a brilliant Anglican layman who really had an impact on Phil named Bill Stringfellow, mm-hmm. Just diving into the ice cream. And these guys were just normal. They could laugh, and they liked to drink, and, you know, they were always available after sessions that they had with people. I can't speak highly enough of them as human beings. I mean, no ego, you know, they were just folks.
Yeah. Again, it's Ted Schmidt, by the way, the author of Never Neutral, A Teacher's Life, and of course, the website, theologyinthevineyard.wordpress.com. Their big moments, the world, I guess, noticed them in 1968. They went with Howard Zinn and others to North Vietnam while the U.S. was bombing, and they were under the bombs.
That's exactly right. And they brought back, as you recall, in 65 or 6 there, three American soldiers that were captured. And I was really, really stunned. He came back and he was a poet. And imagine an American man going into a shelter with the great Howard Zinn. Mm-hmm. And he wrote a poem that really impacted me. It was called Children in the Shelter.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very short poem. He says this, imagine he goes into the shelter with three children. Children having to go in to hide from American bombs. This is the poem. Imagine three of them. As though survival were a rat's word and a rat's death. waited there at the end, and I must have in the century's boneyard heft of flesh and bone in my arms. I picked up the littlest, a boy, his face breaded with rice, his sister calmly feeding him as we climbed down. In my arms, fathered in a moment's grace, the Messiah of all my tears, I bore, reborn, a Hiroshima child from hell. That was Dan Berrigan.
Ooh.
And when Phil died in 2002, I went all through the night by bus with two great friends. And the first person I met at the cortege, I mean, the Berrigan family built the casket for their father. First person I met was Howard Zinn.
Well.
And they and I went up to him and I said, you know, thanks for all of your great work. He was, as you know, a great humble man. Two of them were such friends. And so they had this deep friendship with so many people. As you know, Dan had a special friendship with Thich Nhat Hanh, the famous Vietnamese peace master. So, but also he was very impacted, Phil, by Dorothy Day.
Oh.
I don't know if you knew that, but he said about Dorothy Day.
Go ahead, please.
Dorothy Day, who's up for sanctity in the Catholic Church, was this extraordinary woman who opened these houses for the poor in New York City in the 30s. And they were very close. And he said, Dorothy Day changed me more than all the philosophy and theology because she made the connections. And what were the connections? The connections were with war and poverty. And this hit me home when I was at Phil's funeral. We walked through St. Peter Claver, who was a black saint, because Phil was in an order that served blacks. And you walked through the most desperate poverty in the richest country in the world. And you just said, well, what's wrong with this?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this came out in Michael Moore, who I've often called the most powerful Catholic in America.
Mm-hmm.
Moore is a disciple of those people, his thinking. And in Moore's latest movie, he goes to Europe, and he says, well, you got free schooling, you got free medical. How do you do this? And then you show on the screen 50% of the American GDP for war and the 700 or 800 or 900 bases they have around the world. So Dorothy Day taught Phil to make the connection between poverty and war making.
Mm-hmm.
And that really hit home with him.
Well, I saw a comment that said, you know, we are in this day and age starting to talk about Dorothy Day, Thomas Merton as
yes.
prophets. And they say, well, of course, Daniel Berrigan has to be, let's put it there, with Dorothy Day and Thomas Merton.
Yes.
He was what they call a holy outlaw. I love that title.
I like that expression.
Holy
outlaw.
I
mean, there's a trifecta of Catholic saints for the 20th century. One, the great activist, Dorothy Day, and Merton, the great monk. But what they had in common, and Merton told this to Dan Berrigan, you're not going to survive in America unless you're faithful to your discipline and tradition. Mm-hmm. And part of the great Catholic tradition, is silence and meditation and prayer and mm-hmm. being grounded so you don't get swept away by the diversions of the American Disney culture that is out there. And myself as a teacher, I mean, this was my warning to students all the time. And I had to say, you know, I'm in touch with so many students. Many of them got swept away
mm-hmm.
With the fun culture, with the Raptors and the Jays and the Leafs
yes.
and all of the nonsense that's out there that can deflect you from the serious issues.
Hitting each other with sticks
yeah.
as entertainment.
Oh, exactly. So they, all three of them, you know, were people who were faithful to the discipline and tradition. You couldn't move them.
I noticed, by the way, in the 10, are we using the word commandment? 10 rules that Daniel Berrigan wrote. It included the point, he said, you can learn from the monks.
Yeah.
The idea that, you know, it's not just the activist life, but there's something to be learned from those who meditate or alone and are thinking.
Yeah, and I think that's always been a mantra of mine, that half of you has got to be Thomas Merton. You got to divorce yourself from the culture and get into a space where you're constantly saying, what are my values? Mm-hmm. What do I stand for? Who are my heroes? And, you know, that is necessary. So that's, he wrote a book, as you know, from my blog piece today, I think it's called 10 Commandments for the Long Haul. You know, how are you going to stay at it?
I like that.
Yeah, for
it's
all
also
these
how to
years.
Take a long-distance flight.
Yeah.
Watch the movie, but don't listen to the sound.
That was pretty funny, wasn't it? You know, Phil, he was such a great poet. And he said, I think, I don't know what this poem was called, but he talked about people who can do something for a day. You know, and then there are people who can do it for a week and a month, but how do you do it for a lifetime? And this is one of his great poems. He says this: some stood up once and sat down. Some walked a mile and walked away. Some stood up twice, then sat down. I've had it, they said. Some walked 2 miles, then walked away. It's too much, they cried. Some stood and stood and stood. They were taken for fools. They were taken for being taken in. Some walked and walked and walked. They walked the earth. They walked the waters. They walked the air. Why do you stand? They were asked. And why do you walk? Because of the children, they said. And because of the heart. And because of the bread. Because the cause is the heart's beat and the children born and the risen bread. Well, he's obviously making a reference there to the Catholic idea of Eucharist. Eh? So it's very, very, very powerful about, you know, and you see it. You know, people can get carried away. Okay, you go to one peace rally.
Yep.
But how about being like Frank Scholler, you know, at 95?
Yes.
You know, as long as I've known that beautiful Quaker gentleman in Toronto, he's been absolutely consistent since 1943 when he was a pacifist. And so how do you Nancy Pocock was another great Quaker mm-hmm. that I knew. Mm-hmm. You know, and all the heroes that I knew growing up as a Catholic were people from that great tradition. To stand up, not once, twice, but, you know, try to make a life of it. So,
Bert Brecht said the highest honors go to those who fight to the finish.
Yeah.
Who just stay. It's just, you know, well, it's a spiritual battle, right? Because, after all, you have identified those questions that have to be answered. If they're not answered, you have to keep fighting. You can't say, well, I've decided not to solve it.
Yeah. You know, and he was quite critical of those John Paul II years in Catholicism.
Yes, but how did he weather that? How was he feeling with the arrival of the latest pope?
I'm quite sure he was excited. Because what is he doing? He's bringing back the vision of the Second Vatican Council. That is, Catholics are people who are supposed to get in there and participate in the building of the New Jerusalem, making a better world of it. And when he saw John Paul to come in, you know, with what Dan called Soviet methods, including anonymous delations, removals of people, mm-hmm. Placing into positions of power gray men, company men. Mm-hmm. So he was quite critical, but he had the Jesuit order behind him, and there wasn't much they could do about that. And, you know, this was the flowering of these religious orders.
That's an important element of Catholic politics to understand that.
Yeah, you know, but it was they wanted people just to be yes men. And you can't turn back what Vatican II was. And this pope is bringing it back. You know, mm-hmm. his whole mantra, get close to the sheep. Mm-hmm. I want a church that's poor, that's close to the poor, that speaks on behalf of the poor and not playing this stupid church politics stuff. So, you know, he was very critical of some of the Catholic colleges like Boston College that gave honorary degrees to people like Condoleezza Rice. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
I mean, this is an embarrassment. He was consistent right to the end.
And the fact that he was there, you know, when they did these things, you could feel his presence because of all that writing.
Yeah.
And his, you know, even if he wasn't in the room or if you hadn't seen anything by him lately, you would be looking at Condoleezza Rice and thinking, I wonder what Dan Berrigan thinks of this.
Well, yeah. You know, I was at lunch with him once on a retreat. And since I was very interested in Palestine, he just said to me quietly, he says, well, you know, I learned a lesson very early. This was in the 70s when I went to Israel and I came back and I spoke up about the Palestinians and the repression, mm-hmm. and that was it. Never again on radio or television in New York City. So it didn't bother him. He was a guy who really believed that it had to be said, that the good was never lost. And that's one thing I took away from him, you know,
mm-hmm.
the idea that the good goes somewhere. In all of those years that we'd be vigiling, that I'd be out there with my students against the war in Vietnam, and people would say, well, what's that fool doing out there with the students?
Mm-hmm.
I always believed that, the good was never lost.
Of course.
You just have to be faithful, and even Mother Teresa said that. The whole idea is not to be successful, but to be faithful. Yeah. And who knows? And another great hero of mine, and probably of yours, was Norman Alcock.
Yes.
Who was a great peace guy, an atheist, but a dear friend of mine. And he gave me one of the great lines I ever heard as a teacher, you know, when they said, well, you're a fool. Why did you were the most famous physicist in Canada, and you left and you opened a peace institute and done that in 61. He said, well, you may be right, but I do it so that other people may get their cue to come on the stage.
Oh, that's
it
great.
Was like a Shakespearean play.
Absolutely.
You know, and me as a teacher, well, I wanted to show students, well, that it's not crazy to do these things. And basically, I'm giving you permission now to come on the stage.
Yes.
And we pass it on, and we play it forward, and that's how history gets made.
Yeah.
But we have to have those models.
Yeah.
You know, and certainly Dan and Phil were great models for me.
Indeed. Well, by the way, there's more than one Schmidt. I remember that.
There's a lot of us.
You guys are all getting this idea. Let's get this in the family, get more synergy. This is Ted Schmidt. His book is Never Neutral, A Teacher's Life. Very readable, terrific book. And, of course, is the blog theologyinthevineyard.wordpress.com. And today there's a very good comment and memory about Daniel Berrigan. But just lastly, the plowshares initiation that they
yeah. –
I want to make sure that we mention that. In 1980,
yeah.
they
That's
did
right.
this really dramatic thing of going directly to – I think it was a GE plant.
That's right.
Where they were producing nuclear missiles.
That's right.
That's really looking for trouble, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Tell us what you remember then.
Yeah. And, you know, he took the famous line of the prophet Isaiah of turning swords into plowshares. What are you doing with this metal? You're turning them into swords. They should be, you know, made mm-hmm. into plowshares to create food for people. So it was a symbolic gesture.
Mm-hmm.
But, oh, my, did America ever descend on them? And I can remember talking to Ramsey Clark. I went down for that trial.
Mm-hmm.
In 1981, and I said to Ramsey Clark, what do you make of this? And he was a former attorney general in the United States, eh?
Yes.
He said, it just shows you just how hard it is to be a peacemaker, you know, in this country. When they throw the book at religious people for a nonviolent action,
mm-hmm.
it just shows you, you
well,
know.
They made a film, The King of Prussia.
Yeah.
And Ramsey Clark played the judge.
No, it wasn't Ramsey. It was Martin Sheen.
Oh, Martin Sheen. Ramsey had a part in that film somewhere.
Yeah, he had a part, and actually I'm in the film.
Well, all right then. By the way, what's the correct name of the film so we'll make sure all our listeners are going to see it?
You can catch it on the internet. It's called what the heck is it called? It's called it's Emile D'Antonio's in the King of Prussia, I think it's called.
Yes.
That's where the trial was, in a small town called The King of Prussia.
Isn't that a bizarre? It worked out. It was very poetic, and people remember it because it says King of Prussia.
Yeah, strange.
And here are these religious men who, as you say, are nonviolent, and the state is going crazy to try to crush them.
They tried to crush them, and it sent shivers up my spine. When they came out of that courthouse, and I don't know, there must have been 300 to 400 of us there, and they were singing, I think it was a hymn at the time, and it just sent shivers up my spine. To see these really committed Christians, I said, trying to turn the gospel into reality in the midst of the greatest, as Martin King was saying at that time, my nation is the greatest war maker on the face of the planet.
Yes.
And we saw what happened to King. Well, this is what happens to prophets.
Yes.
They throw you away, 10, Phil did 10 years in jail, but they never stopped. And here's Dan, he lasted to 94, 95, and God knows how many people he influenced.
And came out writing more poems.
That's right.
Doing more work.
You know.
Yeah.
And you know who met them when they came out of prison? My hero, Rabbi Abraham Heschel.
He did. He met them.
He was outside of Danbury, and he died a week later.
Please write a memoir of that, a little memory of that. I know that Ted Schmidt's capable of a poem, but please remember that so that people will know.
Yeah.
That's what a great blog like yours, Theology in the Vineyard,
yeah,
people need to see
that. Yeah, I could
write
something like that because Heschel was this great rabbi, as we know, that said to the synagogue, get outside of your synagogue. The place where you're going to meet God today is in the civil rights movement. And he walked with Martin King and all of those great heroic blacks in Selma, Alabama.
Wow.
And he wasn't the most popular guy in the Jewish religion either.
Yeah.
Well, that's okay. Right. I mean, that's what the prophet does.
And he, like Dan Berrigan, will be remembered for a long, long time because they did.
I think so.
Yeah. Well, Ted Schmidt, it's been a great pleasure. I really hope people go Theology in the Vineyard and read what Ted has got to say today about Daniel Berrigan. Thank you very, very much for being with us.
Thank you, Phil.
Thank you.
Good night.